simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Brothers, sisters, working class heroes, this is the Rick Smith Show. We are here in Memphis, Tennessee. Yes, we have made it all the way to Graceland. Yes, Graceland, the home of Elvis. Elvis Incorporated lives on. Elvis, not so much.
Elvis, yeah. Elvis is in the little house here, the one with the moon on the door.
Yeah.
So you have a picture of him in the RV restroom. How ignoble. Poor Elvis.
Poor Elvis. But again, you know, here's the thing. Elvis the human, not so much. Elvis Incorporated, bang!
Oh, yeah.
There is Elvis everywhere.
Is he still the wealthiest dead guy?
Gotta be.
I think so. He brings in more money than any other dead guy ever.
And John what's Lennon it been? I mean, 1977.
Yeah. Where were you when Elvis died?
I was 10 years old.
You don't remember?
No.
I do. Well, I'm older.
I remember. I didn't care. I knew my mother liked Elvis.
My son was Elvis Presley. When he was 5 years old, you'd show him a picture of Elvis Presley and say, Johnny, who's that? And he'd say, that's Johnny when he was Elvis. And we were like,
nice.
77, 87. John was born in 87. The Buddhists believe that you have between 7 and 77 years to pick your new lifetime.
So there you go.
I'm Elvis's mother.
So now can we make a claim on the Elvis Incorporated?
That's a great idea. You know what? That would be funny radio. That would be great stuff. He even have an Elvis in Hawaii.
Pat,
outfit.
Shirley yeah. McCain's calling.
Oh, yeah. Out on a limb. Out on a limb.
Anyway.
Yeah, but anyway, I didn't have a twin. Remember, Elvis had a twin.
That's right.
Can you remember what the twin's name
I
was?
Back to the whole...
Elvis bobblehead for you.
There you go.
Yeah, if you can get that right. Now, so I was 16, and we were staying at the beach. I grew up in a inner city like you did, and so we'd go to the beach when it was hot. Like it's been, you know, here. And I was walking down the street swinging a radio, listening to the radio, you know, because we had transistor radios then.
Which are going to be back in cell phones at some point.
Really?
Sure. They're going to have to be.
So that you can have radio off
so you
your
can,
phone.
You can yeah. save radio. Because, data's going to be expensive.
That's true. So all of a sudden the DJ came out and said, Elvis Presley's dead. And I was like, what? Nobody could believe it. Who knew that an entire diet of just meatloaf for a year would kill you?
I don't think it was the meatloaf.
No? I think it was over-the-counter cold medication.
I think it was all the drugs to wake up, the drugs to go to sleep, the drugs to go to the bathroom, the drugs to pick his nose, the drugs to mow the lawn. I think it was... I remember there was a Saturday Night Live
skit. You can get drugs to mow your lawn. Wait, we got to back up.
Yeah, I mean, it's the speed to get you... Oh, I don't want to do this. So you get a little boost just to get you moving. But I remember Saturday Night Live had this great skit. And it had the Jim Croce plane that crashed all the time. It had the Mama Cass sandwich.
It only crashed once. That's how those work.
It had the Mama Cass sandwich that had, you know, one bite taken out of it. And it had the Elvis Presley doctor kit. It was one of those little plastic, when you were kids, had the little MD bags with the little stethoscope. And you would open it up and the pills just fell everywhere.
Isn't it weird? You know, they say that women marry their father, right? So what's Elvis Presley's daughter's name? I can't remember. Anyway. She marries, her dad's the king of rock and roll, she marries the king of pop. Her father dies of crazy drug interactions, her ex-husband dies of crazy drug interactions. I mean...
So she's the reason Michael Jackson's dead. Lisa Marie,
thank you. I saw her in concert.
Did you?
Yeah.
She sings?
Yeah, she's very good. She sounds just like her father. She's really talented. and she stands like him, and she wears her
does she shake her pelvis like that and do the shaking
knee
thing?
Yeah, the hip huggers and the, yeah, she's really talented.
I can't wait to go see Graceland, but, you know, because it's just commercial.
I know. It is capitalism at its finest. It's like what we learned about in Blair. Those two people who contested making it a national landmark, and they were dead.
Yeah, the dead people.
Dead people have all the power.
Because they have the money. I mean, I look at this, and it's just Elvis Presley, everything.
Isn't it amazing? We're like a walking, we're at an RV right next to a place just like you and I grew up, a housing project, inner city housing project, and then, whoop, across the street, walk a little ways, you've got the King
Bag,
of Rock and Rolls.
Untold wealth.
Yeah, a mansion.
Just amazing amounts of wealth.
He's buried there now, too, isn't he? I think they moved in there.
I think so. Isn't that where the misspelled gravestone is or something? Is that part of the conspiracy?
The misspelled gravestone?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be cool if we went to Beale Street?
And we found him?
Yeah, I went to Beale Street and he waited on us. I just would so love that. Maybe we'll find him in Roswell.
Quite possibly. Yeah. I'm looking forward to Roswell. I think that's going to be maybe we can take the elevator to the stars.
That'd be cool, and there would be Elvis among the other stars. Maybe.
See, but here's the thing: if he was going to bolt, don't you think he would have taken some money with him so he wouldn't be like a cab driver? Because you always hear people say, "Well, I saw him; he was a waiter, or he's a cab driver, or he's this." You know, wouldn't the guy who was on top of the world had everything? And wouldn't you think he would take a little with him?
You know what you're reminding me of? You're reminding me of. Do you ever watch The Simpsons?
Yeah, occasionally.
You remember that Charlie Chaplin got kidnapped?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they, you know, and they're in Mr. Burns' house, and hanging on the wall behind Mr. Burns is the suit Charlie Chaplin was buried in, you know, implying that he was the one who kidnapped the body. But then, you know, obviously Charlie Chaplin's not dead, so maybe same Elvis thing. I don't know why I went there.
Yeah, I
don't either.
I don't even know how we got on the Elvis thing.
Because we're 5 feet from him.
And again, to me, it's everything that's wrong in my view.
You've got to get a
society.
Rhinestone Elvis watch.
Is that what I got to get?
Yeah, something big,
something gaudy, and something gaudy and ridiculous, and that she's going to feed the storm of.
And your wife, hopefully your wife won't listen. I think you should get her some really, really cheesy Elvis thing and save it for Christmas.
That ain't happening.
You know. Like an Elvis Presley teacup or something.
There you go, an Elvis.
Shot glass.
That ain't
I know. Pill bottle.
Now that, there's an idea, a pill bottle. A commemorative pill bottle.
You know, you could do the 7-day pill bottles and have a Presley.
There you go.
I wonder if they got one of those. They must.
I'll bet you they've got it. If not, there's your niche. You have now struck gold.
I wonder if Elvis Presley's... you know, gift shop and mansion, all that's unionized. I wonder if they're organized so that they get taken care of adequately.
That's a good question.
We're
going to go ask.
That'll be fun.
This whole trip so far has been fun. The idea that, you know, look, folks, if you want to follow us, the People's Tour for America, peoplestourforamerica.com, places we've been, places we're going, things we're discovering, you know, as we sit here in the luxurious trailer park.
This trailer park is really, I have to get more pictures. This is, you know, this, usually people in RVs are those comfortable seniors, you know, that.
This is not.
No. Like, watch for children is more of a threat.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But the other thing we need you to do is we need you to go to the Huffington Post because there's a story about Rick and his family, and I wrote it. And we want you to like it. We want you to share it, like it, share it. Send it to everybody you know. Tell them to share it. Let's raise this up so it gets some national attention because people caring about the history of the common man and about the workers who lived and died and fought and breathed their last to make sure that everybody had a decent bite of the apple. You know,
not even a bite, just a nipple,
a look at.
Increasingly, even a look is too much.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Then you want the apple, don't you?
Yeah. Okay. Then you're gonna watch it. If you don't know it exists, out of sight, out of mind, you'll be fine. But here's the thing: we're in Memphis. What we're gonna do tonight is we're gonna go back and we're gonna look at our conversation in New Market, Tennessee. where we visited the Highlander Center, which I think is an important bit of history. Yesterday we talked about Blair, which I think is one of the most important battles in labor's history. But the Highlander Center is one of those, the Research and Education Center, I think is one of those things that we need to replicate all across the country. There should be one of these almost in every community to educate and to activate people to get into the streets, to be able to stand up and fight for themselves, and to do it in a well-informed, educated way.
Yeah, and it was so beautiful. And she was telling me they're in the midst of a capital campaign so that they can actually expand. And that's good news, I think. It was so cool, too, because it was right in the middle of a farm.
Yeah.
You know, there's a neat, neat place in Maine that you'll have to take the kids someday to go camping. And it's a working, organic farm that lets you camp in it.
Nice.
Yeah, and that was kind of what that reminded me of, little cows and the donkeys or burros or whatever the heck they called.
What I found interesting is when we got lost, going to the Highlander Center, we drove by the body farm.
Yeah, that was.
And our producer thought it was just something to scare people away, like a scarecrow sign.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you what, you go in there.
It's an actual body farm.
I have always wanted to go to
I've always wanted to go there.
Yeah, and I want to end up in one.
That's what I told my wife, especially if they'll pay her for me. By the pound would be better. Because this whole burying thing, people, $10,000, $15,000, $25,000, ludicrous.
You know, there's a place in Georgia, and I think it's being replicated around, though, that's eco-friendly burials.
There's one in North Carolina. It's a green cemetery.
Yeah, and what they do is they plant you, and then they put
inches.
A tree over you.
Well, no, the one in North Carolina buries you 18 inches.
Oh, so something comes and digs you up?
No, just so you get eaten.
Well, yeah, so
because you get down to the 6 feet, nothing gets down there.
Well, these awful rules. You have to have a cement liner. You have to be embalmed. You know, all this stuff. Why in the world would I want toxic chemicals put in my body so they can leach into the ground and get in somebody's groundwater? That's nasty.
Yeah.
Just throw me out in the woods.
Well, you know the reason they put you in those cement encasements, don't you?
To keep the ground from sinking?
Yeah, to cut the grass. Keep the ground from sinking. You have lawnmowers, they've got to go up and down.
It's crazy. And these are the stupid regulations we have, but we can't have you kept safe at your workplace. We get all these regulations about what happens to your casket and whether or not what kind of whatever. And then when you go to work at a fertilizer plant so that the grass will grow, they don't care if you get your arms blown off. It's just, we gotta shake the country up, and so
we got work to do, and that's why we're on the tour. And in the first hour, again, we're gonna talk to the lady from the Highlander Center. In the second hour, we're gonna talk with Gary Moore, the president of the Tennessee AFL-CIO, about the history of the area, kind of get a basic lay of the land, the attacks that have gone on. And also in the second hour, Dr. Timothy Minchin, professor from the UK, gonna talk about the history of the South. I mean, a lot of people, when I announced we were doing this tour and we were going to the South for labor history. Why? Nothing ever happened in the South. There's tons of stuff here in the South.
And I'm a broken record, but I want to keep reminding everybody, myself included, that slavery was the precursor of abusing the worker. I mean, you know, as long as you could pay people nothing, sell their children, cleave their head in half, do whatever you wanted. You know, Frederick Douglass, in his book, he talks about how absolutely horrified he was by white property owners who would lock themselves in a room with a female slave and make new property.
Yeah, well.
And then sell their children off.
Sad, sad stuff. And in the third hour, we're going to talk with Scott Paul from the Alliance for American Manufacturing, because as we were driving here to Memphis, Jackson, Tennessee popped up on the map.
Who knew that Carlisle was right there in little old Jackson?
Right there in little old Jackson. For those of you who are locally in my neighborhood in Carlisle, where they're tearing down the Carlisle Tire and Rubber plant, by the time we get back, it should be all gone. And in a couple months, I'm sure it'll be green, and people have forgotten that for 93 years there was
No, it's going to be a hotel.
It's going to be a hotel?
Mm-hmm. It's going to be a hotel and shops.
Really?
Yeah, for the Carlisle events.
Nice. Wow.
I guess I should say that's rumor.
That's rumor?
But it's a pretty reliable rumor.
Yeah.
I heard it from the night security guard.
Oh joy.
Yeah.
Cannot wait. But where that plant, 93 years in the community creating jobs, decent paying jobs, gone. $34 million subsidy, welfare to Carlisle Tire and Rubber, Tire and Wheel, whatever the name. And now it's a new name because, didn't want to take that name, had to have a new name in Jackson, Tennessee. And, that's what corporate welfare will get you.
I think you're on the FBI list again, too, by the way, for jumping up and down in front of that sign. That was pretty funny.
Well, you got to do what you got to do.
You do get a little wound up.
Yeah, well, it is what we're doing. That's what we're going to do tonight. If you want to contact us, you want to interact, Rick at the RickSmithShow.com or Pat at the RickSmithShow.com. We will be fielding your questions, your comments, thoughts. And if you want to follow us on the tour, PeoplesTourForAmerica.com. We'll have pictures, we'll have some commentary, some stories, some things along the way for you to interact with. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working for you.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
What do you give a guy who has everything?
Labor history, of course.
And where can you get a great dose of labor history?
Right here, weeknights from 9 to midnight on The Rick Smith Show.
From New York City factories to West Virginia coal mines to Oregon loading docks to Toledo glass factories, you'll hear all the stories right here, right up until the new year.
And then we'll be back with all new shows here on The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Independent truck drivers operating out of the Port of Savannah are seeking representation with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. The drivers, who move more than 80% of the freight, say they're being misclassified as independent contractors by companies at the port. Jim Cosmo Myrick is one of those drivers, and he explained why the misclassification hurts drivers.
Due to the misclassification, it allows the companies that we actually work for to call us independent contractors, therefore releasing them from having to pay any employee benefits such as health insurance, unemployment, or retirement. And that's not to mention the taxes that they probably avoid by labeling us as independent.
Myrick said it was deregulation of the trucking industry that led to companies abusing the system. He said being an independent trucker isn't the same as being an independent plumber or carpenter.
We're not independent, though, such as, say, a plumber or a framer or a carpenter. We don't have the independency of moving freight for another company. We are contracted to these people.
A bill that passed unanimously in Connecticut at the end of May will limit the state's participation in a controversial federal program called Secure Communities. Melinda Tuhus reports.
The new law, called the Trust Act, will restrict the use of immigration detainers, which are requests from the Federal Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to local and state law enforcement to hold an undocumented immigrant until immigration officials can take custody of him or her. Ana Maria Rivera, a legal and policy analyst with Junta for Progressive Action in New Haven, says that since Secure Communities went into effect in Connecticut last year, many undocumented immigrants went back into the shadows and avoided contact with police.
We also had stories that were really compelling, stories of people, even citizens, that had been turned over to ICE because there was a mistake, people that had no criminal conviction. And we also had the support of law enforcement. Law enforcement went to testify at the public hearing and said, we have been working so hard for the last couple of years to build a bridge between law enforcement and the immigrant community, and so we want to have that trust back.
Connecticut's law is the first state law in the country to limit the reach of ICE and the Secure Communities program. Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, New Haven.
The Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from the Bank of Labor, Division of Brotherhood Bank and Trust, member FDIC, Equal Opportunity Lender. Bank of Labor is union-owned, union-represented, and the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. The People's Tour for America on the road all across the country. We are in Knoxville, Tennessee, the Highlander Research and Education Center, formerly known as the Highlander Folk School, if I remember correctly. To me, one of those moments in history that you can't go through this area without talking about this. And for me, more importantly, you know, when we named the tour the People's Tour for America, my first thought was, well, discovering America, because there's so much about this great country that we don't know. There's so much I don't know. And when I thought about doing a labor history tour, folks are going, why go through the South? There's no labor history there. Well, I'm discovering there's an awful lot of history here, and that's why we're doing our tour. And you can follow us as we go across country at peoplestourforamerica.com. Find out where we've been, where we're going, what we've found out, what we've discovered, and so much more. I'm sitting here with Stephanie McInnish. She is the executive director of the Highlander Research and Education Center. Stephanie, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, actually, I'm the CFO at Highlander.
She's the money girl.
She's the money person. You know, you go back. It's, when you were on the road like this, it's, you know, it's kind of tough to have all your stuff.
I think we just keep her. She's the money girl.
She's the money
we need
person.
One of those.
We need money. So tell me, you know, as you know, in looking at this center, and I got to tell you, an amazing view looking out your window here. I can't imagine that any actual work gets done looking out the windows.
It's very difficult. Every time someone comes up here for a tour, I'm the first one to jump up and ask them if they like to walk. It's an amazing view.
But, you know, here's the thing. You know, as I'm looking out the window here, I'm thinking back to when this place started back in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And the cultural dynamics and all of the hostility, I can only imagine that a center like this would have encountered, because your core mission at the start, what was the core mission at the start?
There was a couple of people that started Highlander, Miles Horton and Don West, and they started it around the idea of the folk school model of people learning from each other, which is an adult education model where everybody has the information and the ideas to solve problems in a community together, that the community has the solution to the problem. So their mission was to work with rural people and solve rural people problems, but do it in a way that the community was the action behind it, that they made the decisions and they participated in getting action around an issue.
That sounds an awful lot like socialism.
It's far from socialism.
Meaning people coming together, solving their problems. People.
Yeah.
We need.
I think that Highlanders had all kinds of things like that, labels put on it over the years. Socialism. It's a communist training school. But really, it's more about learning.
Center. Right. I saw some of the things. And, you know, I could only imagine, you know, in the 30s when this started, you know, the kind of divide that was going on, because you were actually talking about the entire community, not just segments of it, correct?
Correct. Well, it was communities all over the South that were having issues with poverty and big companies coming in, coal companies, textile industry, and taking advantage of people. And that was in all of the states in the South, and I'm sure elsewhere across the United States. So one community's problems and working on solving that eventually became a bigger movement.
So it was the 1930s, which was during the Great Depression, as people were trying to climb out of that Great Depression. So this folk model, what was it trying to teach people to do? Was it trying to teach people to organize for jobs, or was it trying to teach people to organize for community, as in the woman down the street can watch my kids while I do this? Or what was the goal of it, if this community organization?
Well, I think Miles' goal, Miles Horton, was his goal was to, he saw the poverty. He saw what was happening to his own family. He saw what was happening to his friends and other people in the community. And his idea was just to get the people to work for themselves, that they can make a change in their community, and that they can do it. And to give people the tools to do that was really Miles' goal.
Who was Miles? I mean, what was his background?
Miles was from a religious family that did a lot of work in the community. His mom and dad, they were a very poor Appalachian family. And Miles was actually, he graduated from seminary school and kind of made a road through life of studying adult education and of studying social justice issues, and really wanted to come back home and apply that to his community in the South.
Was this always integrated? I mean, was it always welcoming of people of color? Certainly in the North, there were, I mean, Oberlin College, founded in the 18th century, allowed black people and women, of all things, to go to school from the very beginning. But that was a different story in the South. So was this integrated from the beginning of the program?
I believe that it was. When they started,
that's impressive in 1933 or whatever.
It is. Well, when Miles started doing the labor work, he would do contracts for everybody, black, white, everybody. And oftentimes they would find out at the end of the process that they had just negotiated a contract for both black and white workers. So Highlander was already integrated in the South during the labor movement, which was a big deal.
Yeah, it is a big deal because, you know, if you can get them united, you can't use them against each other.
Correct.
To tear the other one down. And what's always amazing to me is, you know, I talk to a lot of my friends who point fingers at different groups and, well, they're the reason. And you realize, you know, when you get into that pointing the finger thing, mm-hmm. we're all heading downward. If you're going to allow them to be exploited and you're going to allow them to have poor working conditions, it's coming back. And I look at, you know, Bangladesh. You know, if we allow that to continue to happen, how long down the road until it's us?
That's right.
So in looking at this, Stephanie, you go through the 30s, and, you know, and I'm looking at this beautiful scenery and this amazing countryside. You know, I can't imagine the kind of poverty, because the kind of poverty, the kind of hostility that this region would have had. And to have something like this where you're talking about community solutions, I can't imagine that the people who ran the area were all that thrilled.
Right. No, they were not. And there's stories. I call them Paul Bunyan stories about Miles Horton. Because they've kind of changed over the years. I'm not really clear on a lot of them. But I know that some things were said, like Miles was threatened a lot, and he actually was given a pistol at one time to keep in his hotel room. And someone in the community that didn't like the work that Miles was doing at the time actually sent some thugs after him. And so Miles saw them coming, and they were yelling at him that the community didn't need an organizer. And Miles says, well, you know, and he shows them his gun and says, one of you is going to have to come up those stairs first. You're going to have to organize among yourselves and figure out which one that is. So, yeah, there was a lot of tension in the South. And I'm sure that, you know, there were threats and a lot of people against what they were doing.
But, you know, the thing is, you know, we look back, oh, that was the 30s, that was back then. That same mentality is still going on today.
Mm-hmm.
This whole idea, we don't need organizing and we're all individuals. And, you know, it may not be, the, you know, who's coming up and taking the first shot. But, you know, it's still just as prevalent, I think, today as it was then.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you didn't have that push for labor organizing, then people would be taken advantage of. It would just go that way. So we always have to have that push, everybody as a community, to make people do the right thing, to make companies do the right thing.
There's a move in the country, and the biggest sign I saw of it that upset me the most was the United States military's Army slogan, an army of one. I mean, yeah. If that wasn't taking teamwork and boiling it down to every man for himself in an organization that really relies on every man having each other's back. You know, for want of anything else, I'm so anti-war, but I'm so pro that poor soldier and veteran. And to think that they're being sold, join the military by being solitary. You know, it's really it's a mindset we need to break in the United States right now, you know. I can't imagine the grace under fire to see a bunch of guys coming for you and say, okay, you guys need to start organizing because one is going down. Who's getting the short straw?
That's a good line. And I'm sure there are hundreds of those kind of stories. Tell me about the other guy who started the Highlander along with it.
Don West. He came from a similar background. And I think that he actually broke away from Highlander fairly early after establishing Highlander.
So it went through a bunch of trials and tribulations. What I find remarkable is it survived World War II, when pretty much all kinds of things just had to break up because, well, economic prosperity was coming back. You know, Rosie the Riveter, everybody's back at work. You know, everything from the restaurant movement. People ate at home until World War II, and then all the moms worked, so all these restaurants opened up. But this community organizing situation survived World War II. In fact, I think some pretty big stuff happened in 1944.
Mm-hmm.
During World War II, all I recall is that there were some folks that came after the Highland Institute, and they pushed them back. They said, no, we're going to keep it.
Mm-hmm. Highlander got in because Highlander has always been involved and had integrated meetings in the South when it was illegal to have integrated meetings.
Illegal to have integrated meetings. You can't be in the same room with a black person or a white person.
What happened to that freedom of assembly thing?
See, that was written by the white dudes in 17 whatever the heck.
I don't remember that being part of it. I just remember the three-fifths thing. I don't remember the
Well, this was even before the three-fifths thing.
Yeah, no,
the white dudes, no girls probably either.
Well, actually, the person that gave the land to Highlander was a Ph.D. by the name of Lillian Johnson. And she, if it wasn't for Lillian Johnson and a female, who knows where Highlander would be right now.
So this is the land that she gave them?
No, that was a property in Mont Eagle.
So that was the original that the state of Tennessee said, guess what, you don't exist anymore, and we're taking your land.
Yeah, they took our charter and confiscated the land.
Under what ground?
You know, there was rumor that people were selling beer in a bucket for 25 cents. And
is that still a good price? Because I've got a buck up.
But we're pretty sure that the feeling was that Highlander was a threat because they were having integrated meetings.
You need to silence that.
And getting ready for the civil rights movement. And people were already having these integrated meetings, so it was just a natural flow into the civil rights movement and being able to have a place where people can meet about these issues, black, white, across race, and solve problems. And that's what happened. And a lot of great organizations came out of Highlander.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Stephanie McGinnis. She's the operations manager here at the Highlander Research and Education Center, also the CFO, correct?
Correct.
The money person. We like money people because I can't imagine how much money it takes to keep something like this running and you know, where that comes from. And granted, the land is, I guess, yours, right?
Correct.
They can't take this again. So when they took
slow down.
You would hope.
I was reading the signs down in the other thing, and I was saying, my goodness, this stuff's happening again. You know, I mean, it is amazing the surveillance. The FBI put the Highlander under investigation. They were spying on you. J. Edgar Hoover, of course, who was. I don't know.
Well, because King came here, and if you know, Hoover was, you know, just had a fetish for King's sex life, so that.
Yeah, which was pretty horrific.
But you know, and you know, look at the time, you know, after the war. What happened after the war? What happened when they took your land away? What was the genesis of this site?
Well, they took the land in, I believe it was 62, and a couple of organizations like SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, were meeting here at Highlander. And from there, it was the day after that Miles Horton went and got another charter under the name of Highlander Research and Education Center instead of Highlander Folk School.
Right. What happened to the property that they took from you? What did they use that? Was it the coal mining site or something?
No, they sold it.
The Walmart?
Yeah. No, it's actually still a very beautiful piece of property, and part of it is for sale again. So the old Highlander Library is for sale.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
They took it and gave it to some nice white folks.
I would have thought the ultimate would have been either we're going to mine it or we're going to put a Walmart on it.
You've still got West Virginia on your mind. Remember, they take high schools. They took high schools out. They took the high school out and put a coal heap where the high school was. It was the Senate probe of Highlander that I was like, the United States Senate accused you of everything from communism, like you said, everything. And then they did a Senate investigation of this place. When they're after you that bad.
Yeah, that's got to be something. And when we come back and take a quick break, I want to pick up on that theme when we come back after the break. Because I want to really get into that because that's important. Quick break, right back. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
So Rick's off to Florida with his family. We'll be playing encore performances of the People's Tour right through the new year.
No, wait, I'm still here.
Rick, what are you doing here?
Well, Pat, I wanted to make sure that we were playing the People's Tour while I'm gone.
Rick, you and everyone else can rest assured that each night from 9 until midnight, we'll hear some of the very best interviews from our trip across the country, exploring labor history.
Right here, 9 to midnight, on The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Corporate shareholders are revolting in the very best sense of that term. More and more investor groups today are rebelling against the top managers of some of the corporations they own. Why? Because the executives have been gambling on political races, not with their own money, but with the money that shareholders have invested in the corporations. In other words, the execs are treating investor funds as their personal pile of political chips, not even bothering to tell the shareholders about it, much less asking permission or consulting them on who to support. While Washington fiddles with proposals to require that corporate executives at least inform investors about all political use of their money, shareholders themselves are taking action. Since 2010, there's been a doubling of shareholder resolutions at corporate board meetings to force executives to disclose such spending and reveal the process for deciding which candidates to back. A New York pension fund, for example, has compelled political disclosure by the managers of 20 corporations in which it has big investments, including Dr. Pepper, Harley-Davidson, and Southwest Airlines. Recently, this pension fund forced a vote on disclosure at the board meeting of CF Industries. CFI's board had earlier opposed the resolution unanimously, haughtily declaring that our corporate political contributions are always both in the business interests of the company and its shareholders. In other words, go away, little people. Stop bothering us. A pod of slugs wouldn't be as clueless as that. Sure enough, by a vote of 65.9%, shareholders emphatically supported the disclosure resolution. This is Jim Hightower saying, to keep up with this spreading shareholder revolt against secret corporate politicking, contact the Center for Political Accountability at www.politicalaccountability.net.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
We want the world and we want it now. We're going to take it anyhow. We want the airwaves. We want the airwaves. We want the airwaves, baby. If I could stay alive.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. People's Tour for America on the road. You can follow us where we've been, where we're going, peoplestourforamerica.com. We're sitting here at the Highlander Research and Education Center just outside of Knoxville, Tennessee. I've got Stephanie McInnes. She's the operations manager and CFO here at the Highlander Center. CFO, I mean, when I think of this place, I guess CFO would have been one of those things that I go, that just doesn't fit.
Right. It doesn't fit. But you know what's the great thing is that I get to wake up in the morning and go out and feed our chickens and walk around the property. And there's not many CFOs that get to do that.
And it's an absolutely amazing property.
It's
picturesque and beautiful and you know, postcard.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just, I can't, like I said in the last segment, I can't imagine how anything gets done here.
Right.
But fortunately, things do get done. And, you know, you go back through the history of this center. And, you know, when most people first learn about the Highlander Center, they learn about the Civil Rights Movement. It was Rosa Parks. It was Martin Luther King. It was that brought national attention, I think, more than anything, than just local attention. Can you talk a bit about, you know, the center's role in the Civil Rights Movement? You know, what were the origins? What was the beginning?
So people were looking for ways to have a nonviolent action in the Civil Rights Movement, and that's what Highlander was all about. So some groups like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee came out of Highlander, citizenship schools, the idea of the citizenship schools where people were taught to learn or to read and write using job applications, using newspapers. And that way they could vote in the South because you had a literacy test that you had to pass. Especially in South Carolina was where the project started. And that came out of Highlander and then eventually went with some other of the civil rights.
So you spent an awful lot of time teaching people how to
how to organize,
able to qualify just to be able to vote.
Right.
And I think back, you know, you look at this and you go, wow, that didn't happen. What's a little photo ID? And I think of all of the struggles and all of the fight it took to get people the opportunity to exercise their right to the franchise. And now we're seeing those barriers being erected again.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because I saw the poster of Wangari Maathai, who's the Nobel Peace Prize winner, and she ran the Green Movement, began the Green Movement in Kenya. And there are societies, cultures that have fought for democracy where you dip your finger in ink and once your finger's dipped, you voted.
Correct.
And that's all you need. If your fingers hasn't been dipped in ink, you get to vote. And if once it has, you can't vote again. And you see these cultures of democracy building around the world that the Highlander Institute plays a role in. And the next thing you know, you're looking at your own country, which is doing everything it can to take away universal suffrage. And it's really, I do want to get back to Rosa Parks because I think there's something about Rosa Parks that happened here that I don't think many people know about. But before I get there, is it an uphill battle? Do you feel like your work's getting harder and not easier lately?
I think there's a lot more challenges. But I do think that people are aware more than they were because of the Internet and technology, and that I think people are ready to organize and are organizing. I mean, we're seeing it all over the world where people are standing up again and saying, we've had enough.
Are you getting many calls? I see all these things from all over the world. Are you getting many calls from inside the United States? You know, a call from Kansas saying, hey, they're trying to take away my vote? Or
we work with a lot of organizations. Most of them are grassroots organizations that we work with. So in that way, we are working with people who are out in the communities that are trying to make those changes and get fairness.
Now, I'm a white kid who grew up going to a white school in an inner city in New England, right? And it was Catholic school. And I mean, God love the nuns. I don't think I learned much. I do fabulous cursive. But I thought Rosa Parks decided one day she was fed up getting on a bus. And
she was tired.
Yeah.
I was just tired. Didn't want to stand. That's
right.
What I learned.
Well, she didn't want to get to the back of the bus, right? But she was here before she made that action. She had been trained. They didn't teach us. Anybody trained her. So this civil rights movement that mythology said sort of sprung out of a, you know.
Spontaneous.
Yeah. That's such a terrible myth to tell, especially white people, because we think if somebody wanted their rights, they'd just fight for it. No, not when you've been stomped on all your life. You know, you're taught to be down, you're down. And the fact that this center trained Rosa Parks so that she would go back to the bus and say, I'm not getting on the back anymore. Do you interface with people on changing that public perception that she just spontaneously got fed up?
Absolutely. And actually, before Rosa Parks came to Highlander, she was also very involved in her community. And coming to Highlander and meeting people that were like her maybe gave her that inspiration and finally led to that point where she didn't want to put up with it anymore. But there was a lot of training that happened before the sit-ins, before the marches. It was talking about, you know, people are going to spit on you. People are going to beat you. You need to sit there. This is a nonviolent reaction. And they would actually practice people yelling at them, insulting them, before they went out and had these sit-ins and these marches so that they were prepared for that ahead of time.
Education is empowerment. And, you know, the more when you have a center like this that helps bring people some awareness, I think you're right. It does prepare a little bit better, but it never makes it easy.
No, they didn't have an easy road to toe.
You know, it's interesting. That's the reason why they don't want shows like this one, shows like the Rick Smith Show, and other points of information getting out to the average person. The average person is going to stay where they are as long as they don't understand that there are people working together for something different. You know, and that's what's really important about this whole thing is that we get the word out that people have to work together for this sort of thing. People have to come together. How does someone get in touch with you here? How does someone become either a supporter of the Highlander Institute, or if they want to start organizing their community, how do they reach out to you?
We have a website, highlandercenter.org. All of the information about our programs is on the website. We have a lot of opportunities during the year that people can come out. We have something called Wacky Work Week, which you do workshops in the morning, and then you work with us on projects at Highlander in the afternoon. There's volunteer opportunities for people, and all the information is there. And absolutely give us a call and stop by. We like to have visitors.
It's open to the public. What are your hours?
Absolutely. 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, and often there's people here on the weekends.
Now, this library that we're sitting in is like a little bookstore. I didn't get a chance to look at the volumes of what you have back there. What kind of learning goes on, you know, book learning?
Highlander is a participatory action research. That's one of the methodologies that we use. And we believe that people can find resources for themselves. So we help people learn how to research on issues in their community. And we might have done it for another group previously where we could lead people along a path instead of reinventing the wheel. We can lead them in the right direction.
Yeah, I look at this and I go back to, you know, just my learning of history and the things that went on. I wanted to go back to the civil rights era for, if I could, for a minute. You know, in looking at the South and looking at the dynamics, I can't imagine this place had to be a lightning rod. I mean, like the lightning rod for the entire movement. How did they weather that? And, you know, what kind of messaging did they see during that time frame? And do you see some of the same messaging going on today? Because, you know, the more things change, the more they seem to stay the same. Because mm-hmm. we see that word communism being thrown out an awful lot right now. And, you know, socialism an awful lot right now. So I'm curious, in looking back to that time period where Dr. Martin Luther King was coming to the center and Rosa Parks and other folks were learning those organizing tools, you know, what was the messaging attacking the center?
Oh, there were billboards actually put up all over the South that Highlander was a communist training center. We have a picture of one over here that I can show you. There was a gentleman that was very much against Highlander and in politics in Tennessee, and he invested to have these billboards put up everywhere. And
the early Koch boys.
Miles Horton actually said he wishes he would have known, because he would have put the telephone number to the Highlander Center on the board.
Well, I don't think they would have given you that, because you'd actually want that would be able to actually engage people. Because what I find interesting is when you sit and you actually have conversations with people and you try and tear down some of the, you know, the attacks, when people start to talk to each other face to face, I think we can always find common ground. And maybe I'm just a little naive, but I think when even the miners' wives we talked to in Blair. You know, when you talk to just face-to-face and you were able to get past the talking points and the rhetoric, you know, we all want basically the same things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just across
the lines. That's one of the things that Highlander has done through the years, is to build those bridges. There's groups that have connections that aren't connected, and we try to bring them together.
There are groups that have connections that aren't connected. That's great. You know, this is true, though, because it was funny. Rick was talking to these women, and the women were hostile. And, in fact, guys came behind them that were wearing sidearms. And, you know, it was real intimidation garbage, and which Rick didn't intimidate well. But these women are telling, you know, this is my husband. This is my husband, or my dad's a surface miner, blah, blah, blah. You know, we need to take these mountaintops and whatever else they were saying. And then all of a sudden he said, yeah, how's the pension? She said, oh, my God, we're losing our pensions. And then all of a sudden it was that connection that wasn't connected.
Right.
So, you know, in looking to the future of this area, I mean, because, you know, like I said earlier, when I announced we were going to do this tour, you know, people asked me, why would I want to go into the South? There's none of that going on. The reality is there is.
There's a lot going on in the South. The South is still very behind in some ways, as far as dealing with poverty issues, dealing with worker rights, dealing with racial issues in a very much so with racial issues in the South.
And for me, the poverty thing is really, I think everything else is fixable. I think everything else is something we can work past once you get past the poverty. Mm-hmm. Because what I think happens, and you can disagree, is I think if you're on that treadmill where I'm just figuring out how I can feed my family right now, right. You don't have time to think about, hey, I got to worry about the environment. Hey, I got to worry about investments and this, that, or the other thing. I got to feed the kids today.
Right.
And to me, that's a huge problem.
And Highlander's really reaching out to the youth right now just for that reason. And we work with a group called STAY, which is all about keeping Appalachian youth in the communities and keeping those resources and those kids and the things that they have to offer the world local instead of not having opportunities here and they go elsewhere for it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as we were driving through, you know, I got it. You know, I got some information, you know, people emailing me saying, you know, when you're going through here, get a look at this. And Grundy, Tennessee came up, Grundy County, where they actually were using prison labor. You know, and I couldn't have slavery anymore, so let's use prison labor. And it's just one of those moments where I go, you know, there's something seriously wrong with, because I see the same thing happening today.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the question then becomes, how do we make sure that we don't have those divides? How do we make sure that we tear down those walls between each other so that we are truly reunited? And I guess it's places like this that help do that.
You know, if you do that, a whole lot of representatives and senators are going to lose their jobs. Because right now, CCA, the what is that,
Corrections Corporation of America.
Yeah, they want the for-profit prisons, and they want the schools closed, and they're getting their way. And if we start saying I'd rather invest in my kid's future being in a school than being in a jail, and right now a 12-year-old black boy has an equal chance of going either place, you know, as long as we can keep that sort of separation, the people who are going to be making profits on those prisons are going to be making sure there aren't any more schools. And that is really frightening about going backward.
I absolutely agree. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Stephanie McGinnis. She's the operations manager and CFO here at the Highlander Research and Education Center. Last line of questioning I've got for you in looking towards the future, because there are so many battles, there are so many fights, the immigration fights, still everyday labor fights. You know, I can't imagine. You know, it's overwhelming. Resources are small. You know, where do you see us going in the coming weeks, months, and into the years, not only for the Highlander Center, but for this region?
We're still very much fighting issues around immigration. We're very much still very involved with the LGBT movement. We want to see people have opportunities in the South, want some of the poverty issues fixed. Those are some of the things that we'll be working on going forward. Of course, we're still involved with labor issues.
There's a lot of opportunities. Because, you know, for me, it's the poverty thing. And, you know, when you start talking to people, you know, again, I go back to this. I do believe by education and by opportunity to engage that we can turn things around. At least that's my hope.
Mm-hmm.
Stephanie, I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. We appreciate it so much. Quick break. Right back from the Rick Smith Show, the People's Tour for America. And, again, you can follow us, peoplestourforamerica.com. Quick break. Right back. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Pat, I got to tell you, you know, the one thing that really sticks into my mind about being at the Highlander Center, and you listen to that interview, it's one of those things that grabs me. The state of Tennessee actually stole their land.
I know. The state stole their land. The IRS took their charter away, which is, you think about the stuff they're all raving about right now. The IRS is investigating people or unfairly targeting them because of their political beliefs. Okay, nothing new there. you know, these people lost their charter.
Here's the difference.
Their land.
But here's the difference. None of the people that are screaming and running around like chickens with their heads cut off actually lost anything.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, nobody went in and stole their property. Nobody went. They just didn't give them the tax break that they were asking for.
Oh, they did get it eventually.
Eventually.
They just slowed them down.
They had to go through the process. And look, for me, if I'm the IRS guy, I'm looking at this going, the guy who's standing up on the bully pulpit screaming, I'm not paying taxes, destroy the IRS, screw you, is kind of the guy I'm going to look at twice. Just a thought.
Plus, I wish they'd look at them all with a fine-tooth comb. As far as I'm concerned, everybody who applies for a not-for-profit, do them all. You know, let's face it, you're right. The guys who think that everything's wrong with the government, including, like, stuff you absolutely have to have, you know, crapping all over education. Government does a lot of things well. I don't want a bad government, but a good government, bring it on, you know, and that's our job. But scrutinize these people.
Absolutely.
And by the way, don't let the churches off the hook.
I say no tax breaks for anybody.
Yeah, that's fine.
It should all be above board. We should do it like they do to the labor unions. Everything's reported. Everything.
Absolutely.
And this is one of my arguments with a lot of these right-wing groups. They go, well, you know, labor spends money. Yeah, but I know where that money came. I know every dime of it, where it went, who it came from, all of that. Except in your little play world where you guys have created this and it just benefited, you know, a couple people on the other side in a very small way.
Mm.
And to me, that's the bigger story. And you're right. It's the whole structure, the whole system.
But then that whole thing turned out that it was a third of them anyway, which was just third, third, third. And so it was the same ratio as there are right-wing groups looking for tax breaks. But you're right. These people, 1961, lost 200 acres. Taken away and given to white people, and that was the end of it. And the thing that is really remarkable is we talk all the time about the Japanese internment camps, and that was terrible, locking the Japanese up and throwing away the key. 1961! This is how, what, 18 years after 1943?
Yeah.
Makes you crazy.
I got to be honest, though. You know, as I sat there, and I'm looking out across this beautiful span, I mean, the places... Just a beautiful place.
In the Smoky Mountains.
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing. You know, I couldn't help but think, you know, you're in this middle of really nowhere.
Mm.
And you have an extreme minority view where the Klan is having rallies just down the road. You know, that moment where, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, who knows what happens.
Well, you know, Tennessee has a very rich history of deviance, which I really kind of like. And a lot of the Tennessee names are Greek. Nashville and Memphis and all those things. But there was a place in Tennessee called Neshoba. And before the Civil War, it was a big farm, and it was run by just women. All these women, and they did farming, and they happened to do it without their tops on. Now think of this, 1840. So slaves...
Hot.
It was hot, but still, you're a little floppy. You can get some sweaty problems.
Nothing
there.
Wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that.
So they're out there working in the sun and wearing nothing but their skirts.
No tan lines.
And, you know, slaves would run away in the area. And so the overseers and the slave owners would say, I'm going to look for the slaves. And their wives would say, oh, you're not going in the show, bud. And these women were harboring the slaves.
Nice.
Isn't that fabulous? They used the provincial, ridiculous... stupid, stubborn fear of nipples against them. I love that.
Those are fearful things.
Heaven forbid your husband should see a stray white nipple looking for his black man.
Are they white? I thought they're.
Oh, well, you know what I mean. White owned nipple. That's true. How can people be racist?
But no, I mean, I listen to that whole story, and you think about the history of this center. I mean, it's remarkable. Started in the 30s, integration being one of the key components almost from the start. I mean, you go back and you think about this. What a remarkable history.
And one of the things we didn't touch on, we just didn't get to it, and I'm sure it has a pretty big job there, is they do work with the migrant people, migrant workers, migrant farmers. And I'm sure there's a big undocumented worker issue that they probably have to deal with on a regular basis. But that whole, you know, when Alabama passed the strictest immigration laws in the country, they didn't have anybody to work their farms. And they couldn't get the white people to do it. They couldn't get those nice, pale people who get sunburns to do it.
At least not at the wage they were paying.
Yeah, well, and food was rotting in Alabama. So... They tackle a lot of the issues, as you said, LGBT, the stuff that's come forward now is today's new discrimination. What, can't we just get done with that? Haven't we learned that that's just a...
Yeah, and like I said earlier, it's a matter of keeping people divided. We've given labels to all of these different communities and all these different people and all these different thoughts. Everything's labels.
True. Good point. Good point. And with those labels, we do that thing you always talk about where you pay half the people to kill the other half. Or at least crap all over them.
Yeah, it's just amazing. And you know, the thing is, you know, as we move across the country, I just it's remarkable to me.
Can't you just imagine how awful it must be to be a person working 14 or 16 hours in a field right now? I mean, it's pretty warm.
Our poor producer, he's just melting away before our very eyes.
Maybe we shouldn't have made him pick that tobacco before we let him do the show.
Well, there is that. Anyway, we're going to wrap up the first hour. Hope you've enjoyed it. If you want to check out more of what's going on, peoplestourforamerica.com. You can follow us, where we've been, where we're going, the folks we've talked to. Also, you can interact with us, Rick at the Rick Smith Show.com. You can follow us on Twitter Also, check out the Facebook page. There's a brand new show
today. Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Hi, I'm Rick Smith.
And I'm Pat LaMarche.
Thanks for listening to this encore performance of our People's Tour for America.
Gee, Rick, just listening to the show makes me feel warmer.
Funny, Pat. I feel warmer, too.
Oh, Rick, you should feel warmer. You're in Florida right now on vacation with Carol and the kids.
That's right. But we'll be back after the new year with all new shows and some biting commentary for election year 2014.
I know I speak for everyone when I say I just can't wait.
The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Independent truck drivers operating out of the Port of Savannah are seeking representation with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. The drivers, who move more than 80% of the freight, say they're being misclassified as independent contractors by companies at the port. Jim Cosmo Myrick is one of those drivers, and he explained why the misclassification hurts drivers.
Due to the misclassification, it allows the companies that we actually work for to call us independent contractors, therefore releasing them from having to pay any employee benefits such as health insurance, unemployment, or retirement. And that's not to mention the taxes that they probably avoid by labeling us as independent.
Myrick said it was deregulation of the trucking industry that led to companies abusing the system. He said being an independent trucker isn't the same as being an independent plumber or carpenter.
We're not independent, though, such as, say, a plumber or a framer or a carpenter. We don't have the independency of moving freight for another company. We are contracted to these people.
A bill that passed unanimously in Connecticut at the end of May will limit the state's participation in a controversial federal program called Secure Communities. Melinda Tuhus reports.
The new law, called the Trust Act, will restrict the use of immigration detainers, which are requests from the Federal Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to local and state law enforcement to hold an undocumented immigrant until immigration officials can take custody of him or her. Ana Maria Rivera, a legal and policy analyst with Junta for Progressive Action in New Haven, says that since Secure Communities went into effect in Connecticut last year, many undocumented immigrants went back into the shadows and avoided contact with police.
We also had stories that were really compelling, stories of people, even citizens, that had been turned over to ICE because there was a mistake, people that had no criminal conviction. And we also had the support of law enforcement. Law enforcement went to testify at the public hearing and said, we have been working so hard for the last couple of years to build a bridge between law enforcement and the immigrant community, and so we want to have that trust back.
Connecticut's law is the first state law in the country to limit the reach of ICE and the Secure Communities program. Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, New Haven.
The Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from the Bank of Labor, Division of Brotherhood Bank and Trust, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor is union-owned, union-represented, and the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We need to support people who have a history of, know what it's like to sign the front of a paycheck, not the back of a paycheck.
If you're here to represent our mission to our pride, say, say the USA, we're drowning in greed and lies. Say the USA.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. People's Tour for America on the road, traveling, well, near you today. You can follow us on peoplestourforamerica.com, where we've been, where we're going. Got an email from Austin. He writes, if you're going through Tennessee, you have to go to Grundy County, Tennessee, where back in 1892, miners tore down the Tennessee Coal and Iron Railway Company, tore down their stockade. Turns out that the company contracted with the state to warehouse prisoners. And in exchange for housing these prisoners, they got free labor. And in response to the governor, this being torn down, the governor sent 600 militiamen to rearrest these prisoner miners. Austin says the state of Tennessee started leasing prisoners to companies in 1866, three-quarters of which were African-American prisoners. And, you know, you look at things, you know, are we heading in that direction again? Unfortunately, I'd love to go to Grundy County, a little bit further than where we are, heading towards Knoxville. But here to help talk about what's going on, what's happened in Tennessee, the history of workers and labor in the state of Tennessee, I've got Gary Moore. He's the president of the Tennessee AFL-CIO. Gary, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, I think Tennessee, first of all, has a unique history in the labor movement. Unfortunately, we host the first president to utilize federal troops to put down striking workers. And, you know, this happened in 1834. So it's kind of a sad history, but a history just the same. We have, of course, the Memphis incident where Martin Luther King was killed. You're sure aware of the history there of the striking sanitation workers.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and we're going to spend some time, you know, going through that site as well, because I think those are important memories. I think those are important things for my kids to learn and for our listeners to remember. You know, and the thing that gets me is, you know, when I announced the tour and that we were going to go through Tennessee on a labor history tour, and there were people who emailed me and said, Rick, but there's no labor history there. And I'm going, ridiculous. There's worker history all over this country.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the struggles of working people to come from, you know, we used prison labor to today where we're going, you know what? You know, we should make a decent wage. We should have a middle class. And the question I keep asking people is, you know, how do we get back to what my grandparents' generation built where, you know, that labor that we put forth, the wealth that we create, that we share in?
Well, I think that what has happened is this has taken place gradually. The fights that our ancestors fought was hard fights, and we as working men and women have just slowly let that erode, and I think unfortunately it's going to almost get back to the point where we have slave labor again before the citizens rise up and say enough is enough.
Yeah, do you think it has to get worse before it gets better?
I think so. It's kind of like in my opinion, the old adage that you're boiling the frog in the boiling water, you turn the heat up slowly and you boil the frog. And I think that's what's happening to labor, as they've been slowly taking things away. But they've gotten so aggressive with it here in these last few years that I think that you'll see the public rise up and say, you know, this is enough.
Yeah, I hope so, because, you know, I see some of the legislation being proposed in your state and in all the states across this country where you've got Republicans who have absolute control. Here in Pennsylvania, same thing. You know, like, for instance, in your state, there was a guy who proposed, you know, we're going to tie kids' grades to whether the kid gets food stamps to feed himself. We're going to tie their grades to that, which to me just seems just plain mean.
Well, it is mean. It's totally ridiculous is what it is. That's probably the best term to use. It's a ridiculous piece of legislation. Fortunately, it didn't go anywhere, but he'll probably bring it back, no doubt. And I think one good thing about that's one issue where you saw not just union members but the general public rise up and say this is wrong.
Yeah. No, I look at this, and I'm hoping that there's only so much of you-know-what people are willing to eat, and we say enough is enough already, and that there's a pushback. You know, me personally, I wish people would look at labor the same way my NRA friends look at the NRA. That same kind of militancy that, you know what, we're going to protect our job, we're going to protect our family, we're going to fight for health care. You're going to take health care from my family, you're going to take food off my table. To me, that's what labor should, that does stand for and should continue to stand for.
Well, that's basically what we've always stood for, is the right to working men and women have a decent wage, have health care, and be able to have a pension when the time comes. Though, as I said earlier, those are slowly eroding, and I think they have eroded because we have allowed them to do it slowly.
Yeah.
But again, since they've gotten so aggressive with it, I think you're going to see a labor and citizenry in general bow their back and start pushing back.
Let me ask you this, you know, because Tennessee historically has not had a large density of union membership, and there could be a number of reasons why, which I'm sure you would have some opinions on. I guess, you know, why is that? Why did the workers in Tennessee not flock to joining labor unions and flock to organizing to share in the wealth that their labor creates?
I think if you look at the history of the labor here in Tennessee, especially years ago, we were a right-to-work state, which you're seeing happening now in some of these northern states. In a lot of these northern states, they were closed shop states. But again, I think necessity, in my opinion, is what really drives the unions. And if you look at the economic background of the country as a whole for years, the South has always been below the national average in wages and benefits. People grow up or grew up in the South expecting, you know, if they made X number of dollars, that was good pay. They didn't realize that they were being cheated, so to speak, in what they were really worth. And that's what the union did, was educate them. Look, you should be paying, you should be making this much. You should be getting a, you know, 40-hour work week, not a 60-hour work week, you know, and you should be getting benefits. And once they realized that there was better out there, I said, then you started seeing them join unions. And I'm so glad to say that the last data that I've seen come out regarding unions showed a decline nationwide in union participation. But here in Tennessee, our ranks grew by 4%.
Well, that's encouraging because, you know, I keep saying, you know, that at some point there's only so far down you can go before people wake up and go, hey, I'm getting the shaft. But, you know, I've had a number of conversations with people from the South who say, you know, our economy needs more competition and less regulation. And I go, how do you get that? Is it the education process? Is it something that's in the water? I mean, I keep arguing what we need is we need people to have more of a voice and more of an ability to share in the wealth that they create and stop allowing ourselves to be divided. And do you think that, you know, over the years, and I guess race is part of some of this? Yes, no?
I think race is part of it. You know, if you look at the legislation that you mentioned earlier about the food, you know, cutting the food stamps off if the child didn't make a certain grade. You know, let's face it, they can say what they want to, but that was targeted toward a minority group. You know, this legislation was intended to punish minorities. That was the whole purpose of it, and that goes on today, and that will continue to go on. We'll continue to fight it.
Yeah, but here's the thing, Gary. I mean, as a kid growing up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and what I would consider American poverty, you know, we had food stamps, and most of the people I knew who were on food stamps, and the largest number of people on food stamps are they share the complexion that I've got, and I'm fairly white.
Well, the truth of the matter is, you and I know that, and you mentioned education. That's the key to it. We got to educate people. The perception is, and the perception with the guy that was proposing this legislation, I can almost guarantee you, was that the majority of the people getting assistance was minority people, not the white people. But statistics show just the opposite. Statistics today still shows that the majority of people receiving assistance is white people, not the minority race, but it's white people. But they don't. That's not the perception. And you know, until you disprove perception, perception is reality.
Exactly. And, you know, some of the people I've talked to about and the reason that we've taken this tour is I think the education process has to begin because, you know, so much of what the mainstream corporate controlled media has rammed down our throats are unions are something of the past. We don't need that now. And I say we need labor. We need organizing. We need community. We need whatever you want to call it, collective bargaining. We need people coming together today as much as we did 100 years ago. Granted, the employers aren't beating us in the streets and the militia's not shooting us in the back. But hunger and poverty is still hunger and poverty.
Exactly. And I couldn't agree with you more. And now I hope, and all I can do is continue to hope, that the public understands what kind of dilemma the working men and women are in right now. Not yesterday, not 100 years ago, but right now, look at the dilemma that the working men and women are in. I mean, here in the state of Tennessee, they've done away with prevailing wage. They've done away with, just might as well eliminate workers' comp. And I basically told them what they wanted to do was make workers a disposable commodity. And that's exactly what they're headed toward with this workers' comp that they got. You know, they use you, abuse you, throw you out, and get the next guy.
Yep.
And that's all they want to do. Corporate greed. You know, and I get tired of hearing the free market, let the free market work. Well, I believe in the free market too, but I don't believe in a manipulated market, and that's what we have right now. You got certain wealthy corporations that are manipulating the market. And make no mistake about it, there's nothing free about the so-called free market here in the United States.
I'm right there with you. And, you know, on the workers' comp front, I've argued for years that we should do away with workers' comp entirely and give me my constitutional right back to sue the person who caused my injury and sue the, like we had to at the beginning. You know, go back and sue them in court because this system, you know, as you pointed out in Tennessee and in Pennsylvania heading in that direction, completely broken and the compromise completely broken.
Exactly. And I made those exact statements during the debate in the workers' comp. And I said exactly what you said. Look, if you really want to do something for the workers, then just do away with workers' comp rather than gutting it like you're doing it. Just throw it out the window. Let's do away with workers' comp. But let me remind you, workers' comp come about because business wanted it, because they were tired of getting sued and losing in court because they were abusing their employees. They're the ones that come to the table and wanted to create workers' comp. It wasn't the workers. It was the businesses that brought that to the table.
Yep. And here in Pennsylvania, you got the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, who is the biggest at the time. They were the ones who set up the insurance system. And this is a beautiful scheme that only business could figure out, is to get workers to pay premiums to the very people who are beating them down and making conditions worse. I mean, only in America, I guess, that could happen.
And I have to agree with you, only in America.
But, you know, I look at this, and you brought up a couple of buzzwords, you know, this euphemistically named right to work, where there are no rights and there's no work, and prevailing wage, which is always under assault here in Pennsylvania. You know, in a state that, you know, really, you're a euphemistically named right to work state with no prevailing wage laws, what's the construction industry like in your state? What are the wages like? What are the living conditions? What are the working conditions like in places that don't have the same protections that we have here in Pennsylvania?
Well, they up until this year, they had prevailing wage. They had it wasn't a decent workers' comp, certainly better than what it is now. And the construction industry is really the ones that took the real beating this year legislatively. We had and what's the sad part to me? I'm gonna throw this in there. What the sad part to me is that we had what we have always considered our allies with labor, that's Democrats, sitting up there in committee and on the House floor and on the Senate floor, voting with the Republicans on this anti-labor legislation.
Jeez.
Now, that's just sad.
Well, I've always said the Democrats are not your friends. I mean, people look at the people who brought us NAFTA. Look at the people who brought us a lot of these insane free trade agreements. And look, our president right now is proposing to sell off the TVA in your state, which just blows my mind why you'd want to sell off the Tennessee Valley Authority. It makes no sense to me on any level.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the people who keep telling you, I say, you know, watch out for your enemies, but watch out even closer for the people who you call your friends.
Exactly.
Because, you know, at the end of this, and look, we're touring some of the TVA sites as we're coming through Tennessee, something that I think was a smart investment. And while we're talking about, you know, what's going on in Washington and state capitals, to me, the TVA could have never happened today because we've got these austerity idiots in D.C. who think, oh, we need to cut taxes for wealthy people and not invest in our roads and our bridges and education and health care and infrastructure. No, the free market will take care of that. If you can't pay for it, you die.
Exactly.
But, you know, that's a whole rant for another day. I want to bring this back real quick before we wrap up on the history of the state of Tennessee. Because, you know, I think, you know, labor history and remembering the past is so important. And I point to Austin's email of, you know, using prison labor. And, I worry that we're heading back to that before we get any better. And look, I got small kids. I got a daughter 4, a son 7, and a daughter 11. I fear what their future holds for them if we continue down the path that we're on.
And you should have fear. You should fear. And I share your concerns. And what one of the other tactics that they're using now, I don't know, and I hope that they never come back to prison labor, but that may come about. But what they're doing now here in Tennessee is they're going to what they call the part-time worker and reducing their hours so they don't have to pay any kind of benefit at all.
Yeah.
And they're working two people instead of hiring one that would get benefits and get full. I mean, every angle they can take, they're taking it to shortchange the work of men and women in this state.
That's a nice way of putting it, shortchange. I say screw the workers is what they're doing. I mean, because it is what it is. And any time I hear a Republican and a lot of the bent knee Democrats talking about being reasonable or being business friendly, I say clench your cheeks because you're about ready to get something.
Exactly.
Glenn Moore, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the work that you guys do. And thank you for taking time for me.
Sure thing.
Thanks so much. Glenn Moore, president of the Tennessee AFL-CIO. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the People's Tour for America as we go through the great state of Tennessee. Right back.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Hi, I'm Rick Smith.
And I'm Pat LaMarche.
Thanks for listening to this encore performance of our People's Tour for America.
Gee, Rick, just listening to the show makes me feel warmer.
Funny, Pat. I feel warmer, too.
Oh, Rick, you should feel warmer. You're in Florida right now on vacation with Carol and the kids.
That's right. But we'll be back after the new year with all new shows and some biting commentary for election year 2014.
I know I speak for everyone when I say I just can't wait.
The Rick Smith Show. We're working, people.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Congressional passage of the federal budget deal delivers lumps of coal into the Christmas stockings of 1.3 million jobless workers across America. Unless Congress acts to extend unemployment benefits, those workers will be cut off December 28th. The Indiana AFL-CIO is joining labor voices nationwide urging Congress to extend these unemployment benefits. Indiana AFL-CIO spokesman Jeff Harris says that nearly 70,000 Hoosier families will be cut off December 28th, and that's bad not just for them but for jobs and the economy in general.
We just think this is a travesty that Congress is playing politics with this when they should be doing everything they can to help support these people. The White House Council of Economic Advisors is estimating that about 240,000 jobs are on the line in Indiana, just over 3,000 jobs on the line that, you know, if we eliminate these extended unemployment benefits, the consumer demand will fall and those jobs could be sacrificed.
Right-wing anti-union organizations, including the American Legislative Exchange Council, are targeting at least three more states for so-called right-to-work campaigns in 2014. They include Oregon, Ohio, and Missouri. The efforts seek to defund trade unions through legislation. 24 states in the U.S. have right-to-work laws on the books. The laws prevent automatic union dues payments in union shops. Without those laws, unions are able to negotiate dues payroll deduction arrangements with employers. Supported by right-wing organizations and some business groups, the laws are aimed at crippling the financial resources of labor unions. Organized labor and allies are preparing to fight these anti-union efforts. Chicago voters will vote in an non-binding ballot referendum in March on whether fast food chains and retailers should pay workers $15 an hour. Community groups working to raise wages for low-paid workers have delivered petitions to the Chicago Board of Elections to let voters weigh in on establishing the city minimum wage. The ballot question will be whether businesses making over $50 million a year in profits should pay the living wage of $15 an hour. Chicago public media workers have voted to join the SAG-AFTRA union. The vote was 40-7 in favor. Included in the new bargaining unit will be the staff at WBEZ Public Radio. Employees at public radio station KPBS in San Diego also recently voted to join SAG-AFTRA. More than 20 TV and radio stations in Chicago are under SAG-AFTRA contracts. The union represents more than 165,000 actors, announcers, broadcast journalists, dancers, DJs, news writers, news editors, program hosts, puppeteers, recording artists, singers, stunt performers, voiceover artists, and other performers nationwide. The International Union of Operating Engineers is formally reaffiliating with North America's building trade unions. Operating Engineers President James T. Callahan says he's pleased to once again be affiliated with the building trades. Building trades President Sean McGarvey called the reaffiliation a great day for the construction industry in America.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Seems like things are kind of upside down.
choke a few someone to turn around her and cane. He's done it before, he can do it again. This train's coming to town like a hurricane.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. You know, as we were going through, and I had mentioned it a moment ago when we were talking with Gary Moore, this Grundy County where this coal war happened. And again, it's what we were talking about earlier, pitting one group of workers against another group. Or in this case, not even workers, pitting prisoners against workers. You know, I go back to Alabama using prison labor.
Mm.
Yeah, you go back 122 years ago where I just saw, you know, as we were coming across, I just saw that there was a treaty signed. A treaty signed. What's a treaty? Kind of
it's
like
an agreement
between two parties. Yeah. That, you know, you kind of, yeah. This is what we're going to agree. I saw a Republican representative from Tennessee here signed, and some people signed a treaty to end the coal war of 122 years ago.
Now, wait a minute. What's the coal war?
Well, you know, all of the organizing that went on during the boom of the coal industry, what they call in this area, the coal wars. It was in Kentucky. It was in West Virginia. It was in Tennessee. It was all the organizing that went on with the United Mine Workers who were trying to say, hey, you know, we want better conditions. We don't, like we talked about in Blair, where workers were spending their entire lives working for the company store, not making any money. They were making company script.
Yeah.
And you could only spend it at the company store, with the company doctor.
The treaty that was signed was this year?
Just back in May.
Like 2 months ago?
Yeah, just back in May. I think it was May 13th. They had a big ceremony where they brought people out. And it was, as I'm reading it, and I'm reading through this, I'm going, so if I get this right, the state of Tennessee is going to agree to a treaty where the workers were wrong. And the, I think, 27 miners who were shot by the militia, by the National Guard, they were right? And who agreed to that?
Wait a minute now. Who was right? The militia?
The militia.
When the militia was right.
Put down had to put those striking workers back in their place.
The militia
back
was,
in the mines.
The militia, a.k.a. the National Guard, was right when it killed the kids in Ohio.
Well,
when it killed the kids at Kent State, they decided they were right.
Well, in another, 80 years, they'll have a treaty.
to remind everyone that was okay?
Yeah, that's fine. Perfectly fine. And
why did they do the treaty? Just to rub salt in somebody's wound?
I'm trying to figure that out. And when we come back,
to reassert some precursor to martial law? Is that too
either
much
that
like
or,
a tinfoil hat there?
Yeah, maybe. Either that or just to tell workers where their place is.
Yeah.
I mean, because one of the things that I've found amazing in talking with people in that region are, you know, I guess it's better when you know your place. Because then
it's certainly easier.
Then you won't ask for more. Then you won't want to. You know, hey, we don't need health care. We don't need pensions. We don't need any of that stuff. We don't need a living wage. We know our place.
Well, it's that joke you made earlier about you can't even look at the apple.
Yeah.
But it's true. I mean, you. Why would you want to look at that apple? You're never going
to
have it.
Yeah, and I've got to find out. And when we get back to the studio, because I'm going to revisit this, because this is one of those moments where you go, the symbolism, the irony is just so rich in this story that I got to find out who the workers' representatives were. Who were those people's representatives to say, okay,
May or 122 years ago?
Or 22 years ago. They fought a war. How can you retroactively say we're going to have a treaty with the people we killed 122 years ago?
Well, it's easier.
Well, that's true.
I think we're finding that out. You know, like it's easier for Elvis to make money. It's easier for the Blair Mountain petitioners. And it's easier to sign a treaty with people who can't say no.
But I got to find out who the workers' representatives were who signed this. And, you know, did they just do, they had a bunch of school kids out, and they had a, you know, nice little, and to me, when I saw the happy smiling children, I'm going, man, this is indoctrination on the, of the highest level, because the message is the military was right, the government was right, you know, our government, our stranglehold, not those workers who were fighting for better conditions for who? Oh, those kids. I mean, that's the message it sent me, and as you read through this, the whereases, it was just shock. It was just one of those things that stopped me in my tracks. And the bigger question that I have, are we okay with the use of prison labor? Because, you know, this happened right after slavery was abolished. We couldn't use slaves anymore, so, hey, let's lock them up and use them that way.
Now, you and I live in the same town. We live in lovely, scenic Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Have you or have you not been downtown when the guys in the orange suits are gardening?
Yeah, yeah.
You know they're in jail, right?
Yeah, yeah. Look, I'm okay with going to sometimes picking up trash, and because most of it's voluntary just to get out.
It's not voluntary.
Some of it.
Yeah, as voluntary as being in jail can get. Wait a minute.
You you have your choice.
It's like that guy who shot the woman for not turning the trick.
Yeah.
You know, that's not voluntary.
It's about the money.
Yeah, real quick, there was a guy in Texas who just got acquitted for shooting a woman who had agreed to have sex with him for $150, and then she decided not to have sex with him, probably because he was such a charming fellow. She thought she should maybe, I don't know, go home and freshen up. But, no, he sounds like he was a horrible human being. I mean, he shot her. She's leaving the room. He shoots her in the back of the neck, kills her. She takes her a few weeks to die because, you know, she couldn't even do that right.
Well, one of his pieces of manhood were getting off that night.
That is why they carry a gun.
Yeah.
But so
maybe that's what it was. Horse couldn't get out of the barn. Little insult.
The mechanical horse.
Yeah.
Oh.
Little insult.
And of course, she can't be there to say he couldn't perform. So I decided to leave, and you know, it's not my fault he didn't bring his best game to the park.
Ah, good thing you weren't on the jury.
It's a good thing I'm not anything. You're the one who came up with the idea. If I were a caveman, we still wouldn't have fire. I just don't have spontaneous thought. But I mean, so we've got people in jails all over the country who are working.
Good cheap labor.
When I interviewed Sheriff Joe Arpaio, he doesn't just have prison labor. They're still in chain gangs. They're chained to each other. He has child chain gangs.
Nice.
His juvenile
toilets need to be cleaned, like Newt said.
But then kids are chained together. Chain gang.
That's America.
How is that kid going to grow up okay? Do you really even want that kid in your society?
No, we need that cheap labor. I mean, I don't know how many of these stories you've seen over the years, but, you know, you call for airline tickets, you call for catalogs. A lot of times if it's prison people, you're giving your credit card to prisoners.
70,000 children in the United States are in jail.
Well, we got a lot of work to do.
70,000
children. We should have 100,000.
And I was in a kid's jail one time. I was running for governor, and I pretended to be a bicycle repair person so I could get in the juvenile jail. It was a jail that had been reported by Amnesty International for abusing the children. I wanted in there, so I went in. And this kid, I mean, this is the problem with these systems. They were talking about how these children, you know, they were going to rehabilitate them. They were going to teach them the error of their ways. So they had this thing called Scared Straight.
Mm-hmm. I've seen it. Yep, yep, absolutely.
So they take the kids and they bring them into the supermax prisons, and they show them what's going to happen to them if they don't step out.
I watch it on TV.
Yeah. So this kid says to me, you know, they took me to see the kids, the guys from Livermore. That was the town he was from. They took me to see the guys from Livermore so that I could see the bad guys and see what was going to happen to me. And they said, and I sat there with my Uncle Frank. Where do they think I came from?
Yeah.
That is the naivete of stupid white men, pardon the expression because you're a very smart white man, making these dumb decisions based on their own perspective and only their own perspective. And obviously this is Maine that I was in. All the kids were white too. It's just that they there's no stepping outside the box. And I know I was the person who just said,
well, come to think about it. You know, when I was in college, I worked at a juvenile detention center in Tiffin, Ohio, and all white kids.
Yeah.
Now that you pointed that out, you're absolutely right. And I'm sure they went on to the next level, to big prison,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, good cheap labor. And to me, I guess, you know, you go back 122 years, they fought a battle to stop the use of prison labor.
Paxton, which everything in Harrisburg is named after, were outlaws who killed Indians. I mean, we revere the wrong people in this society. Absolutely revere the wrong people. And then these poor people who have no alternatives end up in jail for whatever reason at 12 or 14, usually drugs, and we just throw them away. Or, like you said, harvest them for cheap labor.
But I'm still fixated on this treaty. And it was a Republican who came out and did it. And I've got he's, you know, anti-gay guy, anti-immigrant.
Maybe he thinks it's current events.
anti, well, yeah, well, we're doing something good for the workers.
Yeah.
We're going to make a treaty.
I got me a book here. It says, there's no, what year is it? No.
Yeah.
Sir, it's 2013. Well, there was a teen number in it. 1890.
There you go.
Yeah. Sorry.
But yeah, that's one of those things that I was just fixated on. And we're going to have to, when we get back into the studio at the end of this tour, something we've got to look a little bit deeper into. A lot of this stuff, I mean, as we're going through this tour, I'm looking back and going, there's so many things that I didn't know that we're going to have to go back and we're going to have to do all of this over again.
Well, I was thrilled with about half of the places you've already taken me because I didn't know anything about them, you know? Like, even just the guy who wrote in and said, go to Martinsburg, West Virginia.
Yeah.
I never would have gone there. Had no idea that that huge railroad strike of 1877 that swept everywhere, Baltimore, ended up in Illinois and all of the places started in Martinsburg, West Virginia.
Yeah, but had we not known it was there, we would have never found it.
Yeah, I know. There was going to be no random.
Because it was me walking out onto the tracks going, oh, there it is, while I'm standing on the train tracks. And you on the other side of the fence.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry about
with
that.
With the big spikes.
Yeah.
Do you notice those spikes on the top of the fence?
Well, that's so you don't get too close to the fence.
You'll learn. We'll learn you.
By the way, I just want to say real quick, your kids are being fabulous. We are not just on this trip a bunch of middle-aged crazy people.
My kids are fabulous. My wife does an amazing job with them.
And us. She feeds us.
She's the tolerable one of the two of us. So there you go. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
What do you give a guy who has everything?
Labor history, of course.
And where can you get a great dose of labor history?
Right here, weeknights from 9 to midnight on the Rick Smith Show.
From New York City factories to West Virginia coal mines to Oregon loading docks to Toledo glass factories, you'll hear all the stories right here, right up until the new year.
And then we'll be back with all new shows here on the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. What they do.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. The People's Tour for America. We're rolling through the great state of Tennessee, and I have to be honest, when we announced the rollout of the tour, I got tons of comments from folks going, the South? Really? Labor history? Is there any of that in the South? Well, the reality is, yes, Virginia, there are workers in the South who want to have a decent living. There are workers in the South who want safe conditions. They want a voice on the job. And you know what? They want the same things that workers all across the globe should absolutely be demanding in the South. It's fairly an interesting and painful history with regard to workers. Here to talk about organizing in places like Tennessee in the South is Dr. Timothy Minchin. He is a professor of North American history at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia. Dr. Minchin, thanks for taking time for me.
Sorry, what did you say?
Thanks for taking time for me.
Yeah, no problem, Rick. It's good to be here.
You know, I look at what the statements on the South are, and, you know, you have people saying, well, you know what, there's no organizing that's gone on. The history is, well, labor walked away from the South. Tell me what went on.
Well, it's not really true. There's actually a rich labor history in the South. There's a long history of workers striking and trying to secure union recognition. The real problem, of course, is the resistance that they face, the deep-seated opposition of management to unionism, which is really something that's still there today. That's been an ongoing problem. But if you take the example of the 1934 textile strike, 170,000 southern textile workers walked off their jobs on one day, and that was two-thirds of the southern textile labor force. So this was a huge strike. And you had a further 200,000 workers in the north and other parts of the country that joined them. So almost 400,000 workers taking part in the general strike. In the country that I come from originally, Great Britain, I mean, a strike like that would really be remembered.
Right.
There was a general strike in 1926 that's really remembered in Great Britain. But it's interesting that in the U.S., that strike of 1934 has been largely forgotten.
Well, I wouldn't say it's been forgotten. I think it's been eviscerated. It's been deliberately taken out of our history because what we're told is, well, you know, we have these benevolent corporations who give us these wonderful things, not that people fought, bled, and died for them.
Right, yes. I suppose it's a process of sanitizing the history as well. Yes, as you say, that the corporations have been more generous than they have. But if you actually look at the labor history of the South, it's really a history of struggle and workers certainly being willing to join unions. It's not the case that they weren't willing. And the bravery that they showed was really remarkable in many circumstances. And I think it was worth it in the sense that I think the pressure that they applied actually forced the companies to behave better and to give some of these things that you referred to. So I think that that's only come because workers have put the pressure on them.
Yeah, but, you know, you look at this, and, you know, I guess the question I have is you look back to that time period. What were the conditions like for workers, for their families, for an 11-year-old like my daughter in that industry?
Well, if you go back to the 1930s, the conditions were really bad. You know, the wages were low. It was almost completely non-union. Of course, the Great Depression was the thing going on at that time and made conditions worse. The Great Depression caused manufacturers to increase workloads, the system called the stretch out, and these are the things that really caused these folks to walk on strike in 1934, particularly the fact that the companies were not not complying with the New Deal, the legislation that had been brought in. They thought that this would introduce a fairer workplace, and that the president would support them and the companies would do the right thing, but this didn't happen. So right. they responded with this big strike.
Could you make the argument that the conditions back in the 30s for these workers were much like the textile workers in places like Bangladesh or Sri Lanka or Vietnam or any of these other places around the world?
I think there is some parallel there, yes. I mean, the story of the textile industry is one that it's always had a lot of capital flight. And as it moves from one place to another, many of the same things repeat themselves. So initially the industry started in New England. It recruited mainly young women into the workforce from the countryside. Then it went to the south of the U.S., again, recruited a lot of women. And today it's gone largely to Asia. And particularly China. And in China, you have dormitories of women workers being brought in from the countryside, working in these mills, sending cash wages back to their families. And it reminds me of 200 years ago, the way the industry started in New England. It was a very similar thing.
Yeah, you know, I asked the question because I've got an 11-year-old daughter on the tour with us, and, you know, it's an eye-opening experience for her because, you know, 100 years ago or back in the 30s, chances are she would have found her way not in a classroom but in one of these textile mills.
Yes, and actually the southern textile industry was one where child labor persisted a long time. It was gone really by the 1930s, but it certainly hadn't been gone for very long, and it persisted longer than it in most parts of the United States. And I think it is important to educate children about these things. I've got children of a similar age myself as well, and I think it's important to make them aware of that. And of course, the thing they often say to me is, well, they could have just left. You know, they didn't have to work there. So it's important to kind of explain the lack of choices and the poverty that people experienced at that time.
Yeah, well, where would they have gone? Where would they have gone? You could just leave. And I hear that argument today. Well, you could always go find another job. Well, if they're all of the same caliber, if they're all of the same condition, what's the difference? And I'm of the mindset you stand firm and you make those conditions better so that the next generation doesn't have to suffer.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and they really didn't have a lot of choice. The textile industry was deliberately chosen in the South to be the dominant industry. It had a pattern of locating in small towns where it was the only industry around. So the labor that was recruited, if they wanted an industrial job, that was the only real choice. And although the wages were low, they were higher than in agriculture, which of course was declining and people were being thrown off the land. So the workforce didn't have a lot of choice. And of course this was deliberate. It was designed that way to keep wages down and to control the labor force.
Yeah, it's sad stuff. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Dr. Timothy Minchin, Professor of North American History at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia. Professor, you know, you go to this and you look at these massive strikes that you talked about in 34, where you had hundreds of thousands of Southerners joining with hundreds of thousands of Northerners to make their conditions better. What went wrong? I mean, how did that momentum stop? How did we get to the point now where you have almost no union density in a lot of the Southern states that were going through?
Well, I think the continuity is the management resistance to unionism, the extreme hostility of management, supported by a lot of the elites in the South to unionism, which just made it very difficult for them to form lasting unions. So although there's this history of protest, they certainly tried, they certainly struck, and they were willing to take risks, they were willing to put their livelihoods on the line. It was a different matter to actually forming lasting unions. There wasn't the state support for trade unionism that you see in other parts of the world. So I think that was the real problem.
So what do you say to the person who says, well, the unions, you know, they just walked away from the South? And I know there was a huge organizing campaign back in the 40s and 50s. They dubbed Operation Dixie. Can you tell me what went on with that?
Yeah, Operation Dixie was a huge campaign to try and organize the South that started in 1946. And it actually went on for 7 years. There's often a perception that it ended in 1946, but it actually went on for 7 years until 1953. It was a huge effort. And it really reflected the gains that trade unions had made in World War II when they increased their representation in the workforce a great deal. And then straight after World War II, they tried this big campaign to organize the South. They put a lot of effort into it and again confronted a lot of resistance from management, supported by the culture in the South. The clergy and the community organizations were all very hostile. So I don't think it's really accurate to say they walked away. I mean, their resources were limited, of course, and they did try for 7 years. And actually, when I look back on Operation Dixie today, I think it was amazing that they had a go and they tried so hard for 7 years. I think it's an admirable thing that they really had a go. And,
yeah.
There were ongoing organizing efforts across the 50s and 60s and 70s and the decade that followed. But that campaign was really the biggest single effort to organize the South that occurred.
So what were the bigger obstacles? I mean, was race the big obstacle in your opinion? Was it this euphemistically named right to work that was passed as part of Taft-Hartley? What's the assessment looking back?
Well, I think it was a whole range of things. Race was certainly a factor in the textile industry again, where the workforce at that time was predominantly white, and some companies played on that to say that, you know, the union would bring in black workers that would take away their jobs. They played on the foreign nature, if you like, of the unions that were coming from the north that were more ethnically mixed. So that was certainly a factor. The anti-communism was also a factor at the time.
The red baiting, sure.
The companies linked trade unions with communism. I think management resistance was the main problem. But another thing that I found when I wrote about Operation Dixie was that, of course, it was a time when wages were going up, when the economy was doing very well after World War II, a lot of companies increased wages in response to the unionization drive. So some workers were able to say, well, we're getting a better deal anyway. We don't need trade unions, which they didn't really realize, I think, that, you know, of course, they were dependent on the goodwill of management. But, again, I think the union drive, just by having a go and being there, it had some positive consequences in pushing these companies to raise wages and treat the workforce better.
Which is why I think you're seeing across the country, as union density goes down, wages have gone down just as fast, if not faster. And you've seen the standard of living decline for American workers as well.
Yes, I mean, that's right. I think unions have an effect on the economy as a whole. And, you know, it's not just the percentage that belongs to them, but it helps others as well. It keeps wages up. So those that say that, you know, unions are not relevant, or, you know, you've only got 11% of the American workforce in unions, I mean, the effect of that 11% is greater than the 11% because it helps other workers. And, of course, the trade union movement is a progressive voice in the U.S. fighting for so many things, fighting for, you know, healthcare reform and progressive legislation on a whole range of issues.
You know, and your experience...
its impact goes beyond just the economic, obviously.
Right. And your experience, you know, from around the world, you know, is it harder, easier, the same to organize in other countries as it is here in the U.S., and especially in the southern U.S.?
Oh, well, I'm living in Australia, and certainly there's a lot more state support for trade unions in Australia, although union density has also declined. It's declined from a much higher level. So in the 1980s, over half the Australian workforce was in trade unions. It has fallen since then. But there remains greater state support, and there's greater state support, of course, in Canada as well, and in European countries. So I think for those of us outside the U.S., it's something that is distinctive, really, that this hostility to trade unions, and this fact that I think union rights are not really seen as part of democracy, whereas I think in most countries they are. In a lot of the U.S., it's sort of pictured as something that's not part of democracy.
Right. So are we exporting our hostility towards workers around the world? Because, you know, I make the argument that we absolutely are.
Well, I think to some extent, yes, because, of course, with globalization, you've got multinational corporations, and you've got American corporations that operate in other countries. And the influence of American ideas has certainly spread. I mean, here in Australia, the previous conservative government under John Howard actually tried a reform which they called work choices, which was really to undermine trade union rights. And a lot of the ideas were modeled on the American ideas and copied from the Republican Party. The campaign actually backfired and caused him to lose the election in 2007. But nevertheless, it was an influence of American ideas that he saw.
Let me ask you a last question I've got for you, Dr. Minchin. You know, you look at the South, and we've talked to people as we're driving through, and you know, most of the folks I've talked to seem to be very receptive to the idea of having a voice on the job, the idea of being able to share in the profit that they create. Do you think the South is lost, or do you think there's an opportunity for workers, call it whatever you want, associations, guilds, unions, whatever, to be able to organize and have some sort of a voice?
No, I don't think it's lost. I think the nature of the trade union movement in the U.S. is one of continual struggle, and the climate is a difficult one, but there's always reasons to be optimistic. The recent protests that you've seen in Wisconsin give reasons for optimism. I think that there is this continuity of Southern workers wanting a voice, that you see going back into history as well. Certainly the structures are, you know, loaded up against them.
But, right.
I think that, you know, there is reason to be optimistic.
Yeah, I'm hopeful. And the people I've talked to leave me some great hope. Dr. Timothy mentioned, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
No problem, Rick. Thank you. Good luck with your tour.
Thanks so much. Going to take a quick break. Right back with the People's Tour for America. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
So Rick's off to Florida with his family. We'll be playing encore performances of the People's Tour right through the new year.
No, wait, I'm still here.
Rick, what are you doing here?
Well, Pat, I wanted to make sure that we were playing the People's Tour while I'm gone.
Rick, you and everyone else can rest assured that each night from 9 until midnight, we'll hear some of the very best interviews from our trip across the country, exploring labor history.
Right here, 9 to midnight, on The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com, or the People's Tour for America. You can follow us on the tour as we're on the road. We are here in Memphis, Tennessee, playing the interviews we've done for the past couple of days. And over the next month, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be talking to people during the day. We're going to be going to different places. We're actually going to go to where the people are that we're interviewing. Instead of having them come to our studio or talking to them on the phone, we're going to go out to these places. We're going to see bits of history. We're going to go to museums, and we're going to talk. We're going to the Bush Library. Can't wait for that. Central High School in Little Rock. Discovery of our country.
I'm excited about Central High School. I think, you know, when you think of the bravery of those young people who were escorted by the U.S. Marshals.
You know, and again, you go back and you think about, you know, our conversation at the Highlander Center. It's that education. It's that preparation. It's preparing these activists. And, you know, as Stephanie was telling us earlier in the program, you know, they actually practice being yelled at, having things hurled at them, and you know, the angry, the mean, the all of that stuff, so that, you know, they don't do something that's going to cause something negative, because violence is not going to help.
So when you sit at a lunch counter and you're treated as though you're vermin,
yeah,
you know, I mean, people don't treat dogs the way they treated these people. And so when you're treated that way, you can just take it. When they do sick a dog on you and they bites through your skin, or, you know, they hose you down with
water cannons.
You know, a couple of months ago, it was March or so, I was in Atlanta, and I interviewed, my God, my brain is shot. Anyway, he's the congressman from 5th District
Lewis.
Congressman. Thank you, John Lewis. He said the problem right now with America is, he said, Congress couldn't get, if we didn't have food stamps right now, this Congress wouldn't pass it.
Nope.
If we didn't have a minimum wage right now, this Congress wouldn't pass it. We couldn't get any of the barest, most basic necessities passed out of this Congress. It no longer reflects the needs and wants of the American people, and people need to get in the street and make trouble. He said that when Martin Luther King sent for him, told him to come on down, bought him his bus ticket, said he'd trained him to be an activist, his parents said, don't get into trouble. And then Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King Jr. proceeded to teach him how to get in trouble. And he said, people got to get in the streets and get in trouble. It's time.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you look back to those moments, and, you know, there's so many eerie similarities and so much. You know, couldn't we just learn from the history?
Yeah, yeah.
Do we have to do this every so many years? Do we have to continue? And I hear this a lot with, you know, with the NSA stuff. Oh, we've got to give concessions. We got to give a little. If we want to be safe, we got to give our freedoms. And it's the same thing with work. You know, keep the job. We got to keep the company afloat. We got to give them concession. And at the end of it, you're standing there with, well, right, back to where we started from.
They're eating caviar while they're laughing at you. They're laughing at you, and they're laughing at your Republican governors.
Yeah. Well, if you want to follow us on our discovery
You can go to the ricksmithshow.com or peoplestourforamerica.com as we traipse across the country in our little vehicles. And well, it's so far so good. Quick break, right back with our
10% of people own 90% of the world. We're new to them. Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the world.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
I'm Pat LaMarche, and you're listening to an encore performance of the People's Tour for America. That's when Rick and I and the whole Rick Smith Show took off across the country to learn about labor history. Rick, what are you doing here?
I just popped in to see how the encore performances were going.
Go on vacation already. We'll be back after the new year with all new shows.
Weeknights, 9 to midnight, The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Independent truck drivers operating out of the Port of Savannah are seeking representation with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. The drivers, who move more than 80% of the freight, say they're being misclassified as independent contractors by companies at the port. Jim Cosmo Myrick is one of those drivers, and he explained why the misclassification hurts drivers.
Due to the misclassification, it allows the companies that we actually work for to call us independent contractors, therefore releasing them from having to pay any employee benefits such as health insurance, unemployment, or retirement. And that's not to mention the taxes that they probably avoid by labeling us as independent.
Myrick said it was deregulation of the trucking industry that led to companies abusing the system. He said being an independent trucker isn't the same as being an independent plumber or carpenter.
We're not independent, though, such as, say, a plumber or a framer or a carpenter. We don't have the independency of moving freight for another company. We are contracted to these people.
A bill that passed unanimously in Connecticut at the end of May will limit the state's participation in a controversial federal program called Secure Communities. Melinda Tuhus reports.
The new law, called the Trust Act, will restrict the use of immigration detainers, which are requests from the Federal Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to local and state law enforcement to hold an undocumented immigrant until immigration officials can take custody of him or her. Ana Maria Rivera, a legal and policy analyst with Junta for Progressive Action in New Haven, says that since secure communities went into effect in Connecticut last year, many undocumented immigrants went back into the shadows and avoided contact with police.
We also had stories that were really compelling, stories of people, even citizens, that had been turned over to ICE because there was a mistake, people that had no criminal conviction. And we also have the support of law enforcement. Law enforcement went to testify at the public hearing and said, we have been working so hard for the last couple of years to build a bridge between law enforcement and the immigrant community. And so we want to have that trust back.
Connecticut's law is the first state law in the country to limit the reach of ICE and the Secure Communities Program. Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, New Haven.
The Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from the Bank of Labor, Division of Brotherhood Bank and Trust, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor is union-owned, union-represented, and the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its science, the hopes of its children.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Yes, we stopped in Jackson, Tennessee on our way here to Memphis. Jackson, Tennessee. Pat? Oh.
You know, Jackson used to be a nice thing because I think that's where Johnny Cash's wife there, Roseanne, what was Roseanne Cash? Was that her name?
That was his wife?
Yeah. I think so. that's where she sings it, right? I'm going to Jackson.
There you go.
But no. No one would go to Jackson unless they wanted to throw perfectly good people out of work in Pennsylvania and move all those jobs at a much lower rate down to Tennessee.
You know, and I look at this, and you know, as we were going through, and I saw Jackson, and I said, we got to stop here because I want to see what it is, what kind of welfare we handed out. Because you may remember back in July of 2009, which, you know, you look back almost 4 years ago now.
Yeah.
Carlisle Tire and Rubber, Tire and Wheel said, you know what, we're moving. We got this sweetheart deal because the state of Pennsylvania was only willing to cough up. I think it was like $10 or $15 million Rendell was willing to put forth, and they got a better deal in Tennessee, $34 million plus I guess land grants and all kind of stuff that we'll never know about. You want to talk about welfare? These are the ultimate welfare queens. So I remember them saying, we're moving this plant and it's going to be good for the company. And the article says, good for our shareholders, because that's what's really important. Screw those workers. But I remember at the time talking, because we were on
it. They also said it was closer to the people they needed to ship stuff to, but they left their shipping in Carlisle.
Wow. Yes. Well, we need that market, too.
But they didn't see that they were being allotted 67 jobs in Carlisle to do the shipping, even though they said they were moving the manufacturer closer to who they were.
The people, even
doesn't
though
work, doesn't work, doesn't 60% work,
boys. Of the population's within a day's drive of the location they were in. But, and I go back and I look at this, and I remember because we had numerous guests talking about it during that whole period, because I thought it was another one of those beggar thy neighbor economic development examples, where while on one hand you've got people screaming, those welfare people, they're getting, free cheese or they're getting rice. $34 freaking million.
That's some cheese and rice, baby.
And really, when I remember, I talked to a guy who was...
You can make risotto with that.
You can make something with it. But I remember talking to a guy who was fairly intimate with what went on. And he said, look, when they move this plant to Tennessee, they're going to create, I think he said something like 400 jobs. There were like 380 or 400 jobs lost in Carlisle. But the payroll in the new plant in Tennessee, with benefits and with all of the other costs, was going to be close to, I think it was like a half of what it was. And I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was one of those things where I just stopped. It was such an outrageous amount that I just stopped, and I'm going, that's incredible. But here again, you think about this as a big ship. The U.S. is a big ship. We actually sunk because there was no net increase of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
All we did was we shifted the deck chairs on the Titanic, and we threw some money overboard. Because
money in the safe, and then we threw some of the workers overboard.
Well, there's that, too. Yeah. But, at the end of it, what happened is you've created no new jobs. You had nothing benefited the workers, and their wages went down.
You know what gets me is this is unethical. It's let's forget the fact that it's unfair and it's not nice, or even more, I don't like morality because to me that's so subjective. Your morality is my morality, whatever. But ethics are pretty cast in stone, and it's unethical. And you said someone who was on intimate terms with the details. I think if we made this an intimate discussion, people might understand the ethics of it all. And although probably people get it anyway, they know it, or either they know it and they look away. No, we can't do anything about it, or they know it and they're horrified. But if you were a woman and you had a man who was taking pretty good care of you, and then someone else came along and you could just hop in his bed and have a nicer house, more things you wanted, people would say, oh, my God, what a tramp. But when these companies do that, when they dump Pennsylvania for Tennessee, when they say, well, the bed in Tennessee will be cushier and things will be nicer and I'll have just exactly everything I want and more of it, nobody says, what a skank.
That's a good analogy. I actually like that one.
Thank you. Well, that's what it is. And so you look at somebody and they do it on an individual level and you're appalled. And then these companies do it. Well, it's business. Well, I'll tell you what, honey, trading up husbands is business, too. It's just disgusting.
I actually like that. I may have to use that analogy in the future, and I will give you credit for it. But, you know, I look at this, and you want to talk, and I've used some very, very harsh terms, some have said. I call what these companies are doing economic terrorism. Because you look at the building that was destroyed in Carlisle, a bomb didn't go off, but economic degradation and the building is gone just the same.
And the rumor is it's going to be a hotel and it's going to be some shops, which brings us back around to our beginning discussion of like 2 months ago when we were first talking about this trip, which is the new union jobs need to be the service jobs.
Absolutely.
The new factory of America is the restaurants. And we're going to talk to a bunch of people like that. We're going to get out to Las Vegas, where the largest union is these service workers, bartenders. I mean, this hotel complex with shops will probably employ a couple of hundred people. What kind of wages are they going to have? You know, what's their life going to be? What's their livelihood going to be? It took out 2,000 jobs that paid $35 an hour for what? A whole pile of waitress jobs at $218.
So the question then becomes, and now that you've brought this up, I'm going, well, where's the money coming from? Because here's my view on this, and this is
you mean the Maslin Tire building?
Yeah. I mean, where's the money going to come from to build these hotels and these shops? How much of my tax dollar? How much welfare are we going to have to put into it? And then who are the losers in this? Because there are restaurants in the area. There are hotels in the area. How much of that gets lost? Because at the end of the day, you keep going, well, there's only so many dollars that go around when you're talking about entertainment like that.
Well, and the argument's going to be, I'm not saying if it's true or it's false, but the argument's going to be that it's not going to hurt Carlisle, but it's going to hurt Mechanicsburg. It's going to hurt Harrisburg. People are, instead of staying 20 miles out of town when a car show comes to town or when Dickinson has a graduation or when whatever happens, people are going to be able to stay right in Carlisle because they have they have too few hotel rooms for the events that go on in Carlisle. So that's going to be the argument that, oh, sure, somebody get hurt, but it won't be the merchants in Carlisle. They're all going to get helped by this because they're going to keep more people in the community. Whether or not.
Yeah, the heck with those other people.
Well, screw Mechanicsburg. We ought to put up a wall.
Yeah, let them.
They dropped that damn wrench. What are they thinking? And the pickle people
maybe
in Dillsburg.
Casino.
There you go.
Maybe we could get a
then
casino.
We'll have to have fight with Gettysburg. Well, wait, somebody already did that.
I like it. There you go. Casino. Let's start a casino. Let's start a push for a casino.
You want to have a casino? Let's see if we can get a few of your buddies to finance one for us.
But, you know, I go back to this, and we've seen these examples. And the reason we went to Jackson, I know we did a little video out there with all the eyes peeking out at us and the people driving by going, oh, no.
I thought the fact that the daisies all of a sudden stood up and turned around, you know, I think it was more like a camera there.
It's like going into Blair. I mean, you...
the birdhouses in Blair are cameras.
Yeah, I'm still amazed at the rapid response. I mean, we weren't even out of the car when a local pulls up. Is this the old so-and-so gas station?
Yeah, that was funny. And
it was so cute.
But they were locals. Oops, sorry. That's the other thing. They were locals. That's what Brandon told us. They actually are from towns outside of Blair because there are only 25 people still living in there.
Yeah, but
30
it's not that big of an area that you wouldn't know that.
Oh, yeah, they know exactly what it is, but there are these people that are, it's like calling out the fire department.
I mean, cause
go hose down those liberals.
The woman that I talked to who set up the volunteer who just does it out of the goodness of her heart with the $700-$800 sign holder, mm-hmm. You know, the industrial sign holder with the commercial sign on it for litter patrol. Oh, well, you know, we just do this out of the goodness of our heart, but we do it all the time.
Where did they get the litter, too? Because there wasn't any. And they, like, brought litter in.
But I saw people standing there they were there for, like, 2 hours. Like, 10 of them were just standing in a bunch, you know, a lot of picking up going on there.
Well, it was the chick posse first.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
After the chick posse checked us out and radioed back to their men folk, we got some big fellas here that Rick Smith, and they're all wearing shirts with the same name on them. The Rick Smith Show.
It could be Republican.
Because they're all red, white, and blue. And then the men show up, and the one guy who comes saddle it over like he's, you know, John Wayne with a 8-term pregnancy. And a little bit of table muscle there in the front. He's packing heat, for God's sake. It was just a bully tactic. It was absolutely ridiculous. But it was concerning. We sent Carol and the kids away.
Yeah.
I mean... this, they're not playing games up there.
And then going back to that, I mean, you know, away from the beggar thy neighbor economic development, kind of the advertising campaign that's gone around with this this Friends of Coal. And I love the whole, from a marketing standpoint, amazing. Everywhere we went, there were, you could buy pocket knives with the Friends of Coal on it. You could buy license plates. Well, you name it, they had it right there. Because,
and I coal think is not your friend.
Well,
if coal is your friend, it's inanimate.
But I don't think they care. I think they see it as like a lot of people do. It's their job. It's their livelihood. And they've been sold to, you know, outsiders and people who, because immediately when we came there, we had to be anti-coal.
Well, you had a New Jersey plate on the rented vehicle. That's one thing. But coal is not your friend until it's had about 200,000 pounds of pressure for about 25,000 years. And then it is a diamond. And then your best friend.
A lady's best friend.
Yeah. But
and gets the bigger the coal, the quicker the yes, too, I've been told.
I think that's probably true, unless you're upgrading, like we mentioned earlier. But how can you think that's a good slogan? Is it just because I'm too much of a tree hugger?
Yeah.
Because it's not. Coal is, and I'm not anti-coal. I'm all down on that whole coal fiber thing. I do think that someday, if we survive what we're doing to the planet, three or four generations from now, we'll say, you burned it. Just like they'll say about petroleum products. You burned that? You
made synthetic. Same thing you say about corn.
You make synthetic insulin out of petroleum. What are diabetics going to do when we've just used it all up?
Yeah.
You know? I mean, this makes no sense to take a resource like that and just burn it to anyone except the guy who's selling it. And we're at peak oil now. It takes as much oil to get the oil. It takes as much energy as the oil you're getting. We've lost our mind.
But as long as you're telling people at the bottom of the economics, the ladder, saying this is your only option. There's no alternative. This is all you have.
I have a plan.
Let's hear it. Okay. Plan. Here we go.
Plan. We're going to get the Koch brothers and the Alec peeps and, you know, all the ones that didn't, including the ones that fled Alec like a sinking ship, McDonald's and all those guys. Remember in the 2012 presidential election, they started like saying, oh, no, we're not really Alec supporters. That's not.
Now that we've been exposed.
Yeah. Some of our best friends from the Bangladesh cowardly stuff, Target and those guys who bailed on Alec. But I think we should take all of those people who really don't believe in climate change, and we need to bury them to their neck on the beach. Then you got nothing to worry about if the sea level is really not rising. Right? You're so sure there's no such thing as climate change. We're just gonna give you a chance to get a little sunshine.
Well, no, it's not.
From
it's
the
not,
chin
no,
up.
See here, Pat. It's not that it's not getting warmer. It's getting hotter. It's just that we're not responsible. It's not our fault. It's just natural.
It is your
it's
fault.
God's you, will. God wants it.
It is your fault, but you aren't responsible. You are irresponsible. I'll give you that. But it's not. It is your fault.
No, that's the volcano.
It's cows, like the ones we saw, passing
right.
gas. Rush Limbaugh. You know, I don't know why that guy didn't just become a doctor. He's so amazingly bright. Can you imagine if Rush Limbaugh was your doctor?
Well, he tells me, he says he's right 98% of the time. 98.6 or something.
I think that he just took his temperature.
It could be that good. But anyway, in Jackson, and, you know, I go back to this because, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, I had to see. It's an amazing facility, massive production facility that we're not doing in Carlisle.
You know, they passed a law in the Netherlands, which is, by the way, the wealthiest nation in Western Europe. They passed a law in the Netherlands that it was perfectly okay if you wanted to take jobs out of the country. Okay, fine. Export jobs. You just had to pay the people that worked for you. Until they retired. So you could go pay somebody else 50 cents an hour, but you're still paying the guy back there 35 euros an hour until he retires.
Until he retires. But here's the thing. I mean, there are some that go, okay, fine, until he retires.
I'll tell you when the bottom line, remember what a corporation's job is.
It's quarterly, I understand.
Today's bottom line, they didn't do it. Even places like Nokia. Why do you think Shell Oil still has its headquarters in the Netherlands? Hmm. Not because they wouldn't rather be in the Caymans.
Good point. But, you know, you think about this and you go, well, eventually they go, well, you know, just until you retire, all right, fine.
Yeah, no. It works because that long-term plan is too long. They need dividends to stockholders today, or they're not going to have stockholders. They're going to go to somebody who doesn't live by that credo.
But I look at this, and it just the whole thing just infuriates me. This whole states fighting each other over, instead of creating new jobs and instead
yeah.
of investing in creative ideas and real entrepreneurs who you know, really need help, we're just kind of fighting and beating each other over what's we're willing to do it. And I immediately thought of Zach Womp when I saw the plan, you know, saying, you know, Volkswagen came to Tennessee, a right to work state, less wages, less health care. That's the reason people come to Tennessee. Oh, no, with the free money.
Yeah.
$34 million.
And the RV parks next to a project, a low-income housing project. The RV, the where the tourists.
So you're saying if there's gunshots, we should duck? Or we could end, the program could end?
I think that would be appropriate no matter where we are. Gunshots duck. That's you know that's just a rule to live by, hopefully. But I got to tell
might
you,
that should be a car backfire.
What was really funny, I think, personally, was you're driving along and nobody's paying attention to you but Brett, and you know the kids and I are playing and reading books and writing, and if people don't know what we're doing, we've got this RV with Brett and Rick and myself and the three kids and in the privacy of her own car following us so that we have another vehicle if we need to make short trips is Carol, Rick's wife. So she's following us along and she's diddy bopping around, listening to country tunes and having a good time. And all of a sudden, none of us know what you're doing except you and Brett. All of a sudden, we're pulled over. You're running out in the middle of the street. Brett's got a video camera. Kids are like, what's Dad doing? I'm like, I don't know. So you're screaming, Carlisle, Carlisle. And I'm like, God, he's homesick. So so then you're out there and you're gesticulating and jumping up and down in front of the Carlisle sign. And then all of a sudden, Carol comes running up to the door. And she's like, what happened to him? We don't know.
And we will have the video up at the website so that you can see for yourself. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people. Come to class four.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hi, I'm Rick Smith.
And I'm Pat LaMarche.
Thanks for listening to this encore performance of our People's Tour for America.
Gee, Rick, just listening to the show makes me feel warmer.
Funny, Pat. I feel warmer, too.
Oh, Rick, you should feel warmer. You're in Florida right now on vacation with Carol and the kids.
That's right. But we'll be back after the new year with all new shows and some biting commentary for election year 2014.
I know I speak for everyone when I say I just can't wait.
The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Corporate shareholders are revolting in the very best sense of that term. More and more investor groups today are rebelling against the top managers of some of the corporations they own. Why? Because the executives have been gambling on political races, not with their own money, but with the money that shareholders have invested in the corporations. In other words, the execs are treating investor funds as their personal pile of political chips, not even bothering to tell the shareholders about it, much less asking permission or consulting them on who to support. While Washington fiddles with proposals to require that corporate executives at least inform investors about all political use of their money, shareholders themselves are taking action. Since 2010, there's been a doubling of shareholder resolutions at corporate board meetings to force executives to disclose such spending and reveal the process for deciding which candidates to back. A New York pension fund, for example, has compelled political disclosure by the managers of 20 corporations in which it has big investments, including Dr. Pepper, Harley-Davidson, and Southwest Airlines. Recently, this pension fund forced a vote on disclosure at the board meeting of CF Industries. CFI's board had earlier opposed the resolution unanimously, haughtily declaring that our corporate political contributions are always both in the business interests of the company and its shareholders. In other words, go away, little people. Stop bothering us. A pod of slugs wouldn't be as clueless as that. Sure enough, By a vote of 65.9%, shareholders emphatically supported the disclosure resolution. This is Jim Hightower saying, to keep up with this spreading shareholder revolt against secret corporate politicking, contact the Center for Political Accountability at www.politicalaccountability.net. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
In the factories and the fields, in the city streets and the quiet country towns. Working together like spokes inside a wheel, they keep this country turning around. Hello, Kansas.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. The People's Tour for America, on the road discovering who built this country and who made it great. You can join us along the way, see where we've been, what we've seen, where we're going, and what we're doing at peoplestourforamerica.com. You know, last night I got an email from a listener who heard one of our recent podcasts, and you can get our podcasts at thericksmithshow.com or on the Stitcher app on your smartphone. He said, you know, Rick, I love the show, especially agree with your views on buying American. He said, being from Michigan, I've seen our industrial base be destroyed by bad trade agreements and greed. He said, our nation desperately needs to revive our manufacturing base. He says he lost his job last year when the factory that he worked at closed up and moved to China. And what he says, he found out that our tax dollars subsidized the move, and the company that he worked for that moved to China got subsidized by the Chinese government. He goes, you know, is there something truly wrong with that? And I agree with him. I appreciate the email, Greg. Thanks so much. And the question is, how do we revive our manufacturing base? How do we do what my grandparents' generation did and have a strong manufacturing base with strong middle-class wages? That's why I've asked Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website, to come talk to us about manufacturing and about their report, Remaking American Security. Scott, thanks for taking time for me.
Good to be with you, Rick.
You know, I look at this email from Greg, and I get tons of these from folks who say, you know what, I used to work at this place, but you know what, they moved to places like China, to places like Bangladesh. We've lost our manufacturing.
That's right, and these are more than anecdotes. I mean, they show up nationally. I mean, over the last decade, starting in 2000, we shed about 5.5 million manufacturing jobs. I think it's fair to say that somewhere between 2.5 and 3 million of those were offshored to a low-wage location like China or Bangladesh. And so in addition to losing those jobs, the other impacts are downward pressure on wages as we have more of those low-cost imports coming in for manufacturing workers, but also for workers in the communities where these factories closed. And it's not just me saying that. It's economists at MIT and at Yale that are now saying all of this kind of free trade globalization without a lot of rules has really lowered incomes, widened inequality in the United States, and so the benefit to our economy is none. In fact, that's one of the reasons why we have such a hard time getting the unemployment rate down, getting our revenues up, and getting communities back on sustainable footing.
You know, people say this a lot. Well, it's globalization, and I hear this a lot. And a lot of people, I guess it's easy to say, well, it's this new globalization. But, you know, Scott, I don't think globalization's new. I think our the way we're handling it and the way we're interacting with the rest of the world, that is new. This idea that we're going to open up our borders and, sure, yeah, bring all that cheap stuff in with the low-wage exploitable area. Yeah, bring that in. And I think that's what's new.
That's right. And, you know, we've had, you know, trade for, you know, millennia. If there was some displacement, it was usually corrected by, you know, specialization. But what you have now is a investment and trade policy and a set of rules that were largely written by large multinational corporations that want to produce in very, very low-cost areas without being told what to do, want free access back to the U.S. market to serve consumers here. And, you know, it's not their responsibility to say our economy should be great, but it's our government's.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what the challenge is, that we've had failures among Democratic administrations and among Republican administrations about getting our trade policy right so that it works for people, because we shouldn't be wanting to give away these jobs. Other countries fight for them. High-wage countries like Germany fight for them. Low-wage countries that have autocratic regimes like China fight for them. We don't fight for them, and that makes us pretty unique in the world, and that's one of the reasons why we lost a lot of these jobs.
Yeah, I mean, you look at so many of the Chinese policies, and they're not the only one. They're just the one that's they're the biggest one. With the currency manipulation, the mass subsidies. You know, someone told me the other day that their factory moved overseas, and the company actually, if they get a tax subsidy for everything that they export. So, you know, if they sell anything in the country, no help for them. But if they export it, they get a huge subsidy for that. Have you heard anything like that in the past?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and this is one of the issues that makes it very difficult to compete against firms in China. I mean, one of the reasons is that a lot of firms in China get direct government support. So that's obviously number one. Number two is that the wage rates are much lower. Number three is currency manipulation, where the Chinese game their currency to undervalue it, which gives them an effective subsidy. And number four are these types of rules that make it cheap to export, expensive to import, and we don't have any sort of countervailing policies that effectively stop that. And Rick, I know you know this. When we do try to stop this, it's basically product by product, industry by industry, like on tires or on certain types of steel or on solar panels, and you can't. You know, run an economy that way, because you're going to have too many cases like that. And instead, we need some direction from above, from the president, from the Congress, that says our goal should be to balance trade, should be to reduce our trade deficit with China, make sure they play by the rules, so that we have more of that production here in the United States. And you're right, it's with other countries too, Rick, not just with China. But that should be the overarching goal of our trade policy, instead of how many of these agreements can we sign. That's the wrong metric, but that's the metric that we've had for way too long.
Yeah, I mean, I go back to John McCain when he ran for president. His slogan was country first. And there's part of me that goes, you know, that should be our trade policy. Look at what's best for our country first, and you know what? Then go from there.
That's right. That's exactly right. And for this shouldn't be rocket science, Rick, because we have had presidents dating back to our founding fathers who are on record saying that we should limit imports, we should have trade, but that we should have the domestic capacity to make our food, to make our manufactured goods, and in particular to make products for our national defense.
Yep.
So that we are not dependent on other countries in a time of crisis.
You know, I go back to World War II when my grandfather, you know, we fought in World War II, and he said the whole reason that we were successful is because we could outproduce everyone else. We had this major manufacturing, our entire economy ramped up into manufacturing. And, you know, before he died, he said his concern was for our national security, because, you know, this was back, you know, 15 years ago. He said, look, we're giving away our manufacturing capacity. We're letting it go away, and it's not that we're losing; it's we're giving it away.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and I think your listeners would be shocked to know. I mean, first of all, they know about the cyber hacking because that's been in the news, and then it's just been in the news recently that China actually has the blueprints to some of our weapons systems,
yep.
the tanks, the aircraft, all of that. But what a lot of people don't know is how many Chinese parts are in our military now.
Yep.
Everything from night vision goggles to the rocket propellant for Hellfire missiles, and fasteners and semiconductors, advanced fabrics, and all of this, and how much of our military is now made in China. And that, to me, is just frightening. And I'm not saying that we should go to war with China. I'm not saying necessarily even that, that China is an enemy. But China is certainly a rising power, and we know what the Chinese military has done on cyber hacking, on stealing these blueprints, and it's just a common-sense question. Why in the world, if you want a secure country, would you want your defense industrial-based supply chain to be dependent on China for lots of different critical materials and parts that, that we don't have the capacity to make here because they've been offshore?
Yeah, for the last couple of years I've been talking. When I had interviewed Hillary Clinton back when she was running for president in 2008, she told me about the plant that used to make the only magnet that went into our smart bombs. And there was only one place in the country that made this. And that, you know, back then, a Chinese company had bought that company up, crated it up entirely. Every piece of machinery, crated the entire factory up, shipped it to China and recreated it there. And now they're the place that makes this specialized magnet, this specialized thing that makes our smart bombs smart, along with the chips that we need to make our smart bombs smart. And you go, well, what sense does that make on any rational level?
Yeah, and it makes absolutely no sense, Rick. I mean, the idea was initially that we wanted a peace dividend after the end of the Cold War, and so that the military, instead of buying military spec'd materials, would buy what's called commercial off the shelf, which is, you know, just like you would get, you know, if you went to the hardware store, although with some specifications. That actually led to a lot of outsourcing. And you're right, on the magnet issue, you know, the MagnaQuench plant was in Valparaiso, Indiana, which is close to where I was raised. And those magnets are used in a lot of very sophisticated systems that we have. And it's everything from fasteners, which are much, much more basic, to those magnets, to the what you call the rare earth elements that are in our night vision goggles, to titanium, lithium ion batteries. You know, it's just and you look at all of our weapon systems and the stuff that keeps our troops safe, and whether or not you're for military action or anything like that, you want our troops to be equipped with the best stuff in the world.
Absolutely.
We can protect our country. And it is just, it's a shame that we don't have that. So we do have this report, Remaking America, Remaking American Security. It's 335 pages, which is a lot, but it dives in some of these vulnerabilities that we have and our national security risks within the defense industrial base. And it should be a wake-up call, because whether you're a liberal, a conservative, a Democrat, a Republican from the East Coast or the West Coast, you want our country to be safe. And this is a glaring vulnerability that we have.
Yeah, and beyond that, for me, it says, you know, what kind of an economy do we want to have? If we're spending money on these things, what kind of jobs should those be? Where should they be? Who should they be for? I mean, if you're talking about national security in making weapons, shouldn't that national security also be creating a strong enough economy that, well, we can afford the things? Just a thought.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, you should. It's just common sense that you want to spend as much of that money here at home. And the World War II example is the perfect example about how we were able to prevail, in part because of our manufacturing might. I mean, there were a lot of factors that went into it, but that was certainly one of them that helped the U.S. stand apart. And then, you know, since most of our economy is a civilian economy now, you look at, how do you make have sustainable economic growth in communities? It's not through Walmarts. It's not through hotels. It's not through McDonald's or fast food. I mean, those are all important jobs, and we should make them jobs with dignity. But the things that are going to grow communities and provide jobs like that are factories and making more of what we consume in the United States. And that grows jobs in manufacturing, but it also grows jobs in retail, in service. It brings revenues into the government, and so it eases our fiscal position, and it's just a very, very very smart thing to do, and it also allows us to innovate the next best thing in the United States. We've seen some recent decent news about that. You see Motorola saying it's going to build smartphones in the United States. You see Apple saying it's going to build one line of computers in the United States. Whether or not these are tokens, I don't know. I think it's too early to tell that. But it is a somewhat positive sign that after decades of offshoring by these very companies, that you're seeing at least a bit of that returning to the United States instead of it all heading in the opposite direction.
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, for me, it's that reverberation effect that, you know, if there's money being spent in the local economy, it's going to reverberate and other jobs will be created. And then that snowball effect of growth and opportunity instead of the other way, where we're losing and we're losing and we're losing and we're seeing contraction. And what bothers me, and last line of questioning I have for you, is I look at what our Congress has done with this screwquester. And as we go across the country and we're talking to people, this screwquester thing, this government spending being cut back, my question becomes, one, good bad policy in your mind, and two, how much more is it going to make your report and all of the vulnerabilities in our supply chain, how much is it going to make that worse as companies continue to outsource and look for cheaper opportunities to make the same money that they were making before the screwquester happened?
Rick, it's a very good question. And, you know, cutting back public investment is a terrible idea, especially investment in people, investment in our infrastructure, investment in our future innovation. Especially at a time when borrowing costs are very low. They may never be this low again. And so it's like, why wouldn't you want to spend some money to rebuild those 70,000 bridges that are deficient in the United States? Why wouldn't you want to spend some money to make sure that we have the best innovation hubs in the world so that we can invent the great things of the future right here? Why wouldn't you want to spend some money investing in vocational education again, since shop classes and the like were decimated over the last couple of decades? It is just common sense. And I, you know, I will tell you that I'm not much of a forecaster. That's not my training. But I imagine that one of the biggest things that's going to be holding our economy back over the next 6 to 9 months will be this reduction in public investment. It just doesn't make sense. And just, you know, one last point that I think is very important for your listeners to understand is that manufacturing can thrive, but it's also important that these jobs be good jobs.
Yep.
They be well-paying jobs, and unionized manufacturers are some of the most productive in the world. Our steel companies, our auto companies, our aerospace companies are all heavily unionized. They're all highly competitive, and they work together. And you look at our high road competition, companies like, or countries like Germany, and there is a serious amount of collaboration between the unions, the business, and the government to make sure that manufacturing is thriving. I mean, that's the type of model that we need to have in the United States, which is that collaboration, that investment in workers, the realization that unions are part of the solution for this, especially when we want manufacturing jobs to be good jobs, family-supporting jobs, where folks can own a home and live in a safe community. So, manufacturing takes the right policies. It obviously takes smart entrepreneurs, good business people, but it takes a great workforce, and a workforce can only be great if they acquire skills and they are compensated fairly for those skills as well. But that, you know, that's the solution to many of our economic challenges that we're facing.
And if the workers have a voice as well, and you look at Germany, since you brought them up as the example, there in Germany, workers have a seat on the board of directors. So they know what's going on within the company, and they actually have a voice in it. And as I always say, you know, if you're not seated at the table, chances are you're on the menu.
That's exactly right, and that's the important thing. And I'm privileged to work with a union as one of our stakeholders, the steelworkers, that does have a voice on some of its corporate boards here in the United States, and adds a lot of value to them because they can make joint decisions on where to deploy capital in the United States, how to make sure that workers are fairly compensated, and it makes the companies better, it makes the workers better off and have more job security as well. It's just common sense.
Common sense, and I wish Congress would get their heads out of their holes and head down that road towards full employment and good employment. Scott Paul, I appreciate the time, President of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Thanks so much.
Thanks, and best of luck to you on this tour, Rick.
I appreciate it. Right, quick break, right back. ThePeoplesTourForAmerica.com. If you want to know where we've been, where we're going, follow us. Quick break, right back. Stick around. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Here with Pat LaMarche, we are in Memphis, Tennessee, on the People's Tour for America. You know, Pat, last night, dinner, Beale Street, blues, wonderful music, in the restaurant, Sirius XM.
Wasn't that crazy? The home of blues and the home of radio.
Yeah.
And thank you, Mr. Satellite World. It was crazy.
Yeah, I'm sitting in, I'm listening to the music. You know, we're walking down the thing. We see the live music in one side of the room. We go into the restaurant. A little too loud on the live side. Over on the other side, Sirius XM.
My favorite line, though, as we walked into Jerry Lee Lewis's restaurant was, "Watch the girls," which is what you said to me.
Well, I was not.
Of course, this place lets children in.
Of course they do. Not my favorite, not my first choice. You know, with an 11-year-old daughter, hey, Jerry Lee may be roaming the president. Well, we went to Jerry Lee Lewis's.
When we tried to go to B.B. King's, no, he wanted them 21 or older. So there was our problem.
There was that. And you walked away from Pig, which probably would have been fantastic.
You think?
I don't know.
The place was empty.
A place named Pig?
Yeah. I thought it was calling me names. Oh, yeah! Smarty!
But an interesting evening.
He wasn't that thin himself.
No.
He had a lot of nerve.
Yeah.
You know, though, the ribs fell right. I mean, they jumped into your face. They fell off the bone.
So instead of what we've discovered is Memphis ribs, but I think I knew that.
Well, that's the only reason. I'd never had ribs before because I have a...
You've never had ribs before?
I have never had ribs before.
Never.
I grew up in an Irish family. We had, like, mush, you know, mashed potatoes and fried hamburgers was pretty much... No, so or if we had meat that was kind of barbecue meat, it was hot dogs. You know, we didn't have ribs. So once I got grown up enough to have ribs out in public,
have had them.
No, I never had them.
Never
last night. No, and I just never ate them because I'm like, I'm not eating those in public.
A Rick Smith Show exclusive.
Really? Yes, that's true. That's true.
So
I've also never traveled 7,800 miles with a radio family. That's another, I mean, I've traveled distances, but this one eclipses them all. And
yeah.
That's pretty good, because I ran for vice president. It's hard to, like, really do too many new remarkable things, but this...
You've literally been everywhere.
I have. I've never been to Memphis, and I never had ribs, so this was pretty cool. I've probably been to 300 cities in the United States, at least. Never been to Memphis. So that was pretty neat.
And we're going to go, tomorrow we'll discover more of the city. Looking forward to going to the Mason Church where King gave his final speech.
You know what I noticed just from reading things and, excuse me, sort of, this is a violent history.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, when we do the history of the labor movement, and we are talking real violence, and I keep bringing up the slavery thing, which is pretty violent, but even just the beer I ordered last night was named after a man who was hanged off a bridge. He was in a militia fight with a bunch of workers. It was a coal thing, and they hanged the guy off the side of a bridge. And I don't mean like by his feet. Ha ha, isn't that fun? Okay, let him back up again. I mean like rope around your neck until you're dead. They named the beer after that.
It was his ghost.
Yeah. Well, it was lovely. An apparition like that I could take a couple of times a day.
Wow, okay, well, I mean... is what it is. But it was a lovely meal. We had a good time last night. I'm looking forward to investigating and discovering what Memphis has tomorrow. You know, obviously we're going to talk about the sanitation strike. We're going to talk about King being here. Maybe stop at the National Civil Rights Museum, which I found out closed on Tuesdays.
I know. The only museum on the planet. I mean, even in Europe, the museums are only closed on Mondays. Yeah. We got to close on Tuesday. You know, though, another really important part of human history And what little we have is thanks to the labor movement, but we just don't have enough in this country. And I didn't know this until your wife brought it up. St. Jude's Hospital is here. One of the very few places a child can go for free health care. Well, unlike the rest of the modern world where every child has free health care, you know?
Yeah.
A hospital that is just completely dedicated to taking care of children right here in Memphis. I didn't know it was here.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Yeah.
Until, because, well, the kids, they go and they do fundraising for the Children's Miracle Network. Isn't that what it is?
No, St. Jude's Hospital.
Or Danny Thomas's.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And, you know, so we're going to go take pictures of that as well.
Yeah.
And you can see that on our Facebook page. You'll be able to see it on peoplestourforamerica.com. More of the things that we're discovering. And originally, like I said earlier, you know, this was, you know, a discovery tour.
Mm-hmm.
So it was more of, you know, discovering the country. And as we move into these different areas, you're discovering along with us the things that we're finding out.
And you know, we've all really kind of worked on putting this together for the last few months. So if we're having this many aha moments, you know, I mean, Danny Thomas Way, I wonder what's on that. You know. By the way, we're changing our clothes. We just have a lot of the same shirts. If you're looking at the pictures, you're like, whoa, those guys are getting ripe.
Well, there's a hose.
There is a hose. There is, but we actually are changing our clothes after we hose ourselves down.
Yeah, because, yeah. You know, coming through the South, it's a little warmer here.
And
we haven't even gotten into the really warm areas yet.
It's funny because I'm thinking the toughest part of this whole trip is going to be the Southwest, because even when I was here in January and February, the toughest part was the Southwest because it was so hot and so dry. The dryness is incredible. But I'm thinking now I'm okay with dry. I'm looking forward to dry because it's pretty humid here in steamy Memphis.
We're drinking the air along with the beer named after the ghost guy.
That's crazy, isn't it?
It's nuts.
Yeah. A spirit. Maybe that's what it is.
There you go. So you've now made the connection.
Jeepers, it only took me hours. I tell you, wouldn't have fire.
What?
If I'd been a caveman, still no fire. Wouldn't have had fireworks.
And we wouldn't have had ribs. So fortunately, you didn't have to do it.
That's very true.
But you know, one of the other things that's caught me so far on this trip, and maybe it'll change, but the thing that's really grabbed my attention is, you know, I really thought there would be, in the places where we've gone, and now it could be different once you get off more of the beaten path and more into the rural areas, that, you know, the less travelers, that there would be a local flavor that you wouldn't have all of the same chains. Man, it's the exact same things everywhere we've gone so far. All of the McDonald's, the Wendy's, the Bob Evans, these big huge chains.
I know, isn't that awful? You really could travel this entire country and, regardless of the fabulous, wonderful local culture, never touch it. I will tell you one thing, though, that I am dying to further explore, and I think I may be able to on this trip, because last time I did this, I traveled with a health nut. The entire Southwest, all donut shops. All mom and pop, handmade donuts.
That's what I need.
I know. We're going to look like policemen by the time we're done. I have no idea why it's like that, but every
it's because it's hot enough you can just put the dough out on a rock.
But it's amazing. I mean, Indian bread. I know donuts were invented in Maine, but Indian bread is like that, and Indian bread is so good. They deep fry this bread, and oh my God, you know, Native American bread probably is supposed to be called by now, but you get this Indian bread. It's sweet and it's fried. It's not uber sweet like a donut. But then I don't know what happened. It's like every street corner there's a different Fred's Donuts, Walter's Donuts, you know, Sigmund's Donuts. Every place has their own hand cut, handmade donuts. It's exciting.
Great. Is there a labor story there?
There's got to be.
Because we could probably...
We'll keep looking.
We will keep looking. You know, a couple of the other things I thought were interesting about being in Memphis, and as we walked through the city last night, just in a really short, quick way, you know, you saw, you know, first black bank, first black DJ.
Yeah.
And I thought it was funny, the first black DJ in the country, and then you got serious on the radio.
I know. It's just... It's bizarre. And the other thing I thought was neat about Memphis is it's got a real New Orleans flavor. There was live music everywhere. In every
Beale
restaurant.
Street.
I know, but every restaurant and every bar, there was live music. But then there was also live music on the street.
Yeah.
So you can live music in front of the establishment, live music inside the establishment, live music in the park. It's just like, I was impressed, but then it wasn't crowded. Is it because it's hot? Would it be more crowded in the winter here? I don't know.
Your guess would be as good as mine, but I enjoyed it because that's my kind of music. I love the blues.
Yeah, it was fun.
And you know, I love the craft and the musicians, you know, practicing and doing their thing. Too much of what we've, to steal a line from Dan Aykroyd and the Blues Brothers, too much is this pre-programmed electronic disco nonsense.
Disco. Well, they have new things since disco.
Well, I mean, it's all this pre-programmed. Yeah. The techno and all the...
I'm sure Brett would back me up on this. I guess, and there are people who can play an entire symphony just using the keys of a laptop, you know? Each laptop key can be a different instrument. So you can be playing your laptop keys and be playing a trumpet and then lay down another track where your laptop keys are the notes of a guitar. And you can make your own symphony just from your computer laptop keys.
So we no longer need to have actual instruments.
Yeah. We have Sirius. That was crazy. That, and leaving Talkers magazine where, there was an awful lot of people there, talk radio hosts, that didn't have a earthbound signal. You know, everybody was just coming out of a satellite.
Yeah.
That's kind of, I guess people might have mourned the loss of the horse and wagon, but was it somebody?
The guy who couldn't drive.
Yeah.
Which if you go back and you look at the history, the Teamsters were one of the, when that happened, that move into from the horse-drawn buggies into the automobile, one of the things that they negotiated in their contracts is that improvement in technology, that improvement in skills, that the people who were riding the teams got trained first to drive the trucks.
I know I'm going to sound incredibly stupid here, but I always wondered if that's why they were called the Teamsters from way back when there were horses pulling the stuff.
That's the reason the horse heads are still on their emblem.
Oh, cool.
Because, that was their start. And the history of it is just fascinating. And, you look at the conditions before the Teamsters came along. And we'll probably talk about this further down the road. But, the conditions were 16, 18-hour days. Yeah. Where you may have gotten paid for 6 or 8 of them.
Wow.
Because all of the time caring for the horses, grooming them, saddling them, feeding them, all of that stuff, you didn't get paid for.
Well, would they change horses out on a trip?
It depends on how far you'd go. I'm sure they did.
Like 16 or 18 hours. It probably didn't work the horses half as hard as they worked the men.
Yeah, well,
oh, no, we're going to take care of the horses.
As an old miner told me, he said, you take care of the donkey because they can replace you. The supervisor and the owners were more concerned about the donkeys because those were hard to get. You, not so much. It goes back to what my grandfather told me about when he was in World War II. He said, look, be aware. The tank, they have a harder time replacing you. There's a million of you behind you.
Yeah.
You're easily replaced.
Yeah. A World War, but that's an interesting thing about how pervasive and hard it was to get. Horses were used in World War II, too.
Yeah.
They invaded Russia with horses. It's amazing. Now you couldn't even imagine using a horse in a military engagement,
I can't imagine using a horse for anything.
I've only ridden a horse once, and I wouldn't kick it, so we didn't go anywhere.
Okay, well, there is that.
They'll like, kick the horse. No, really.
See, I kept kicking mine to stop.
Him. Oh, really? That would be funny to watch.
That's how I met my wife. I mean, first time we met was, she was leading a tour.
The horse outran hers. Come back here, you pretty blonde.
No, she was leading the tour, and my horse just followed her. Followed the horse.
Sugar cubes for that one.
Absolutely. There you go.
Hey there, fella.
And, I think about that time quite often because she was a volunteer guide on this trail. And we were told that at the end of the trip, you give a tip your guide. Because, you tip your waiter, tip your waitress.
Give her your phone number.
Give her your phone number. So I threw in a couple extra bucks there thinking, Mr. Big Shot, Mr. Big Tipper, whatever. She never saw the time of it. I had no idea what it was. Because they found out the people who ran
this. Stole her tips?
Yeah. Took all of it.
See, this is the stuff they do to people.
And I'll never forget that, and it's infuriating to me.
You should. Are they on our ride?
No, they were up in the Poconos.
Oh, that's too bad. You know, they need a poke in the nose.
There you go.
Yeah.
More than that.
Awesome.
But yeah, that was, you know, I've ridden a horse a couple of times. Never fallen off, fortunately. Anyway, peoplestourforamerica.com. If you want to follow along with where we've been, where we're going, any thoughts, hey, where we've been, you've got some ideas, rick@thericksmithshow.com. We answer all emails, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on where we're going. We'll see you back here tomorrow. We'll be in, well, I guess Little Rock by tomorrow.
Wow.
Yeah, good fun.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.